You probably know the hits.
Those guys?
You probably know the hits.
So anyway, that was that's just a funny little members.aol joke.
Yeah, speaking of making shit up, welcome to You Probably Know the Hits. I'm Jason. That's Jeremy.
Yes, sir.
Episode 5? 6?
Oh, I think we're on number 6 of Pink Floyd.
Let's see, because it was the early years. It was Dark Side.
Dark Side.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wish You Were Here and the Animals. That's another episode. That's third. We got, it was 4 Floyd was the one. Wall 1, 5 was the wall 2, and here we are on the wall 3, which is episode 6. Yeah, man.
And this is where we talk really only about the trial.
Which, coincidentally, though we might talk for 4 hours, is actually shorter than the track length of this track when you actually listen to it. So we're going to try and speed through it here, obviously, to...
As we usually do.
Yeah, yeah.
We just hit the really important stuff and get out of here. Man, you know, here's the thing. We're here today to talk about one of the things I've been fascinated by for years. I don't know if you, like, through the years have done as much reading or has been as intrigued about this subject as me, but the very ill-fated Wall tour that happened, but just kind of barely. And in my mind, for years, this tour was basically only a rumor, because there was, you know, especially before YouTube, you would just read things about it. Like, yeah, there was a Wall tour.
Right.
And it was an amazing spectacle, but they only did a few shows and that was it. They put it away and never did it again. They were offered like insane amounts of money to do more in big stadiums, which of course would have defeated the whole purpose, because Roger didn't want to do that anymore. But that was it. They did a few of these Wall shows. It was a difficult production. It was expensive. They lost a bunch of money. And they never did it again. If you look on, I saw a list of like greatest tours of all time on Rolling Stone. And I think they had this tour somewhere in the mid-20s, somewhere around 25.
Which is nuts, because they had like 6 dates or something, right?
Yeah, it had 30. So it had more than you think.
30?
Yeah, it had more than you think, but it was spread out over like a full year. It was spread out from like February of 80 to like June of 81.
Holy shit.
So it was spread out like about
30 shows. That's insane.
But then it was also like 4 cities. It was LA, New York, London, and Dortmund, Germany. And that's
it. Okay, that's what it is. So they have like multiple nights. They just do it over. They get that fucking set up, which takes weeks. Oh yeah, holy shit. Yeah, look at this. It is like 7 or 8 dates in Los Angeles, and then and that's in February. This is okay, so they do Los Angeles, and then they do Uniondale. I have no idea where the fuck that is.
That's Long Island.
Oh, okay, all right, fair
so
enough.
I don't know.
That's their quote unquote New York City show.
That's New York City. Yeah, I guess Madison Square Garden wasn't available, so they had to do Nassau Coliseum. Okay. Which that's a famous concert venue.
Yeah, I mean, it fit 72,000 people. So, dude, like, I'm confused about, we got a lot to talk about here.
Yeah.
I thought this thing lost money, ultimately, and Richard Wright, I think you mentioned, was on salary, so he's the only one that made it. Meanwhile, I mean, maybe it was the production, like, getting all the stuff together or something or whatever, but, dude, this Los Angeles attendance thing, maybe it's just the max is listening. I would assume it probably did fill the max. 7 or 8 dates, 126,000 people every single day.
Right. No. 126 total.
Oh, over shit. All those dates. Over 8 dates.
Yeah. That's the LA Forum, so it only holds like 20,000 people or 15,000 people.
Oh, man. That puts a dent
in it. So, like, Uniondale, that only holds, like, Nassau Coliseum only held probably 14,000 people.
Okay, so check my math here. I'm pretty bad at it, but generally, 126K at Los Angeles, 72K at New York over 5 dates, another 120 in London, 130 in Dortmund, Germany, and then another 100,000 over 5 dates in London again. 500,000 lucky people in the entire universe saw the show.
That's right.
And there's, I'm sure, some people who were at multiple dates just to see it over and over again because they were rich and they knew this is the most important time of their life. And so it's even less than that.
Sure.
Yeah. I had no idea. Yes, I guess I had heard, like you said, I thought it was something like basically had they, man, the, my recollection is thinking that they did like one or two shows like once and then realized it was like losing money so bad they just stopped or something, you know.
Correct. And that's a common thing to think. In fact, I was listening back to a radio segment from a local radio station here, who all three of the guys on this show went to see Roger do The Wall back in 2011.
Right.
And so this was a segment from like the next day or the next Monday when they talked about it. And they said the same thing, like, and they didn't do any research. They were just like, yeah, I think Pink Floyd tried to do this show, like, back in the early 80s, but they only did, like, a few shows and then just abandoned it.
Right.
Like, I think that's the perception of this tour, is that they were ready to do a big tour, and then it was just such a disaster that they just, like, were like, nah, fuck it. But it's not going to work.
But here's what flies in the face of that, right? It's like, if you thought of that in general, you'd be like, well, yeah, they did do five cities. But you're looking at the dates on the left here, and it's like they did Los Angeles and New York in February, basically. It was like 7th mm-hmm. through the 13th in Los Angeles and 24th through the 28th of February 1980 in Uniondale. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's, you know, basically February. And so you're like, well, yeah, if this is tanking, then like, of course they're going to go on to London and then the other one, and then, you know, they'll be done by March. No, no, no. They don't go until August, like a 6 or 7 month like break till they do London. I'm very curious to hear about what the fuck happened there. And then again, same thing. Like, they do August, and like, maybe these dudes are just living the jet setter lifestyle. That would be my first guess. I don't know. But then again, after that, which presumably, if this rumor is true and they're losing money, they're like, you know what? Next February, let's just do it all over again. So now a year later, in February, they do Germany. And then 4 months after that, they do June, like a whole run of them in London. Now, when you started talking about this, I was immediately picturing the famous like U2 shows and Metallica shows of late that have the huge wall screen like Roger did for the 2011. And I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before, maybe not, but those screens take like, you know, a team of hundreds of people to pull down and put up, and it takes like three or four days to pull it down and another 2 or 4 to put it back up, or to really prep a whole arena for that. So when you're playing Cowboy Stadium in the Dallas, Texas area, you have to rent the fucking place for a week and have people, hundreds of people, putting up this stage and tearing it all down and whatnot. So they put it up for 3 days. The show happens for 3 hours. They pull it down for 3 days. For 3 hours, that stadium is full of people, and all the other times, like, basically there's nothing that can happen at the Cowboys Stadium because there's refuse all around from a stage being built or being pulled down. Now, on top of that, you got to have another road crew, and you're renting multiples of these screens, because if you want to play more than one show a goddamn week and not have a world tour that takes 7 years to complete, now you got 2 of these screens or 3 of these screens. So you got teams of hundreds of people, you know, leapfrogging. They tear down the one in Dallas, and they're going to go to, you know, Nashville or something next. But meanwhile, the one from 3 days ago in L.A. just jumped forward to Phoenix, and you're going to bounce over there on an airplane and play that one and whatnot. So I can see how Los Angeles, for example, right, is, you know, let's just fix that problem altogether. Let's set the shit up and play 8 nights in a row there. Or whatever.
Right, but most bands can't do that. Most bands don't have the drawing ability to play 7 or 8 nights in one place.
Did they sell them out? Were all these shows like universally sold out?
Yeah. Really? Well, okay, so let's back up a little bit. We'll get to the shows. We got to get to the idea of why were they even doing these shows in the first place. So when they did The Wall, Roger had this idea ahead of time. This was going to be a 3-part thing. It was going to be an album. It was going to be a tour. It was going to be a movie. And the idea behind the show was they were going to do the show to incorporate parts of the show into the movie. Now, if you've seen the movie, as I have, and you have, you know that not 1 second of any of those shows is in the movie.
Interesting. Right.
But that was the idea. The show was supposed to be part of the movie. And that's that would one have been reason. So bad,
but okay, yeah.
It's one reason why it's so theatrical. It's supposed to go with it. It's supposed to, and the movie's real theatrical and over the top, right?
Right,
so
sure.
That's what it's supposed to be. That was the idea behind it. By the time they started producing the shows, they were already sketching out the movie, and it sounded like, I think Gilmore said, by the time they started really putting the show together, it was already clear that the shows weren't really going to be much of a part of the movie. But they were doing all this at the same time. They were sketching out the movie and the shows, like, kind of at the same time. And so they build out the show, and I think Roger has said...
Can you give me a breakdown on this? Because I feel like we talked about, or maybe it was in the book I read, that, like Gilmore or something, like the Rogers, the big picture guy, and Gilmore would do specific things, like sort of... get cue cards and shit ready, or get like all the like logistics of a particular show going and such. This you're mentioning so much is going on at the same time. Is it sort of like Rogers focused on the movie stuff and Gilmore put this show together? Is it more of a team effort? Is it nobody really gives a shit and Rogers is crazy doing everything all together?
I honestly think this was all mostly driven by Roger.
Okay.
I think Gilmore's biggest voice was in the making of the album.
Okay.
Where it sounds like there was some real compromise. But when it came to the movie and it came to the tour, I don't know that Gilmore had much to do with it other than to be there and play.
Okay.
That's the sense I've always gotten.
Okay.
But, you know, again, this run of the tour was so short, there's not a lot out there about it.
Yeah. I was shocked when you sent me that video a couple weeks ago that there's a full 2-hour fucking shitty VHS quality, but it's like you can see on YouTube like an entire wall show. I had no idea such a video even existed, period. I thought this was something that was lost to the sands of time completely.
You know, there's actually two of them.
Okay.
There's one from Earl's Court, which is one of the last ones in 1981. There's one from Nassau Coliseum, which was one of the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the one from Nassau Coliseum was the reason it was filmed was because it was meant to be like a warm up for the film crew.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they were going to film one later, you know, supposedly for the movie. But it was poor quality. Gilmore has said it's poor quality. The lighting wasn't right. They couldn't agree on exactly how to film it. But Gilmore has said that he would really love to see Roger take those movies and, like, restore them and put them out. He thinks they'd be awesome.
Which, again, from our fans who listen to the 9 hours of The Wall we've covered so far, you mentioned,
right.
I think, the last episode, that Roger ultimately, when they start splitting up and stuff, gets ownership of everything The Wall related.
Correct.
So Gilmore can basically just kind of, you know, I don't know, do an interview in Rolling Stone, you know, or maybe if he would ever deign to text Roger and be like, hey man, you should XYZ, but he has no say whatsoever in anything The Wall. Okay, interesting.
I can't believe Roger hasn't had these Wall videos taken down from YouTube.
Right.
Like, I cannot believe they've been allowed to stay up. But I watched half of the first half of the Nassau Coliseum show today.
Okay.
Just to kind of really get more of a... I put it on my regular TV instead of on my phone.
Yeah.
Just to kind of get a better feel for what it looked like.
Right.
And so they put these shows together.
Yeah.
It was enormously expensive. And one thing that they knew, and Roger knew... Like, you just couldn't go small. You know, Pink Floyd had already been known for a big stage show.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have their biggest, most epic album ever, which I think what he felt was the most, you know, the biggest, most important message that he had to get across. Like, this had to be epic. This had to be a major, major show.
Right.
And when you watch it, I think that I said this about the album, and I'll say it about the show. It's not even a concert. Like, it is like a Broadway production.
It is,
where Roger is playing a character. I mean, he is literally in, like, a hotel room set. He is in costume. Like, he is playing a character throughout the show. It is a Broadway-level production.
Right.
Which got me to thinking, man, if there was a... Even if it was no members of Pink Floyd, if there was just a Broadway production of The Wall... I would be there.
Right.
I would go see this thing in a heartbeat.
Yeah,
no question whatsoever.
Yeah,
and I think it'd be a hit. I think it'd be huge.
I think The Trial would be the biggest hit on Broadway.
It'd be my favorite. It's biggest hit in my heart. You know, so okay, so we have the idea of it, and
so you say it costs so much. Do you mean like sort of planning it and stuff? Because I remember if you look at the, I'm pretty sure it's the wiki about the tour, or no, you know what? There was a video I saw about the tour that the guy. We'll link it in the podcast thing, but the same dude who gave that pretty cool animals breakdown that I saw a few weeks back, and he was mentioning like all these specifics. I think I sent you a screenshot of one that was like a little bit of a like cutaway picture of like what's inside the inflatables, and it wasn't just like that. You know, I've seen pictures over the years, and it's like, dude, they have like a 30-foot inflatable of the mom or of the professor or whatever. That's pretty cool. Then you realize from this dude's like live footage of it that they actually had like headlights in the guy's eyes. So it was like this floating balloon that has somehow lights as the eyes that are really strong, like penetrate into the audience and whatnot. And this guy has this cutaway schematic of it, and it's like a fucking, it's like a, you know, Chuck E. Cheese, Showbiz Pizza, you know, Disney Small World, like animatronic, like robot on steroids inside of a balloon with tons of like what looks like electronic shit going on, all this kind of stuff. Like, that ain't free, right?
No. Not only is it not free, it wasn't, you know, the inflatables were one thing, but the guy who did these animations, which the inflatables were based on, this Gerald Scarf.
Yeah, right.
You know the name, right? I mean, he did these animations for the show, basically. And I think some of them, they ended up in the movie.
The guy mentioned in this YouTube thing that one frame of animation took one animator a full day. So, like,
okay, there you go.
1 second of animation takes one animator an entire month of work.
Yeah, so this is involved expensive production. Not to mention the fact that you also had to manufacture like however many bricks for this wall, because the whole point of the show is that the band is going to start out like at the front of the stage, and then slowly the wall is being built in front of the band, and so to basically accomplish this character's, you know, ultimate feeling of being completely separated from the audience.
Right.
And that's what happens throughout the show. You can see like workers like bringing bricks out and building the wall piece by piece as the show is happening. Which I think somewhere I read like the bricks alone were incredibly expensive, to manufacture.
Yep. They could smash down to, I'm scrolling through our old text here or whatever, but they could like smash down to a certain size, you know. And they were like, and they weren't small bricks. They were like these like not inflatable, but like I don't know, maybe cardboard or something. But they were like, you know, 5 feet wide by 2 feet tall by a foot and a half deep or something. They were sizable little chunks of something to keep on working with, you know?
They're big. I'm sure you had to have so many of them be replaced every show, because at the end of the show, the wall gets knocked down.
Right.
And I'm sure they get damaged and crushed and everything. So that in itself was really expensive. You had these metal stabilizers on hydraulics that had to come up and like keep the wall in place so it didn't fall down before the end of the show.
Jesus.
And keep in mind, so like the best comparison I could think of was a few years before this, you had The Who did their concept album Quadrophenia.
Okay.
And they tried to stage a Quadrophenia show that was very like multimedia centric. It had a lot of, you know, backing tapes, it had video, and nothing worked. To the point where they truly did abandon it after a few shows. The rest of the tour, they just turned it into more of a conventional show.
Like all the cues for everything happening.
Yeah, it just fucked up. Yeah, you couldn't time it right. The tapes wouldn't work because none of this is on computer.
Oh, that's like, right. It's all fucking analog. It's
literal tapes that are like in there, like reel to reel type shit. And if it doesn't work, you're screwed. Yeah. Like if the backing tape isn't working, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right.
And when the whole show is based on that kind of stuff, then it like there's a lot of potential for it to go wrong. So This was quite an undertaking, and I think pretty damn brave to try to even pull off
right
for this band. And they did it. And Roger, so they designed the show. When you see the, there's a documentary I sent you, but so much stuff we've sent back and forth. I don't know if you saw it. There was a documentary that didn't look like it was ever released about, like, it was like the stage setup of the wall.
Okay. No, I didn't see that.
And it's like a crew, like, following around. The road crew is there setting up the stage the day of the show. And you can just see, like, it's like building a small city. I mean, it is so labor intensive to build this stage.
Man.
To try to take it from city to city on a nightly basis would have been, at that time, impossible. And I know Roger figured it out later how to make it work. One thing that probably made it work when Roger did it in the 2000s was probably the fact that ticket prices had risen quite a bit. Right. And you could charge $200 a ticket.
Right.
Back then, I mean, top ticket prices, I don't know, $20?
Right, exactly.
Maybe. Like, I mean, I was reading in 1984 when Michael Jackson did a big tour with the Jacksons, and they charged $30 a ticket, and people were outraged because that was so much more than what was normally charged for a concert. So right. The wall couldn't have been more than that. So
$12.50.
Are you kidding me?
$12.50.
Jesus.
No wonder they lost money. Jesus Christ.
I know inflation happens, but my God.
I mean, $12.50 times 10,000 is 100,000, right?
Yeah, 120,000.
Dude.
Yeah.
That's professor by itself costs 120,000 to get going, right? I mean,
well, yeah, and then just, again, the crew to set it up. Because normally what a big production does is they, like you said earlier, they make, like, two or three of these stages,
mm-hmm.
of these setups. And there's always one on the road, right? To the next.
Because, like, it sounds like they just set it up and then take
weeks. I think
off
it was so – I think they didn't want to do that. And Roger said in this documentary I saw, Roger said this was always the plan, to just do a few shows. Okay. Because it's too big. It's too involved. To try to move this from city to city would be impossible.
Okay.
I'm sure with the technology of today, it was much easier to pull off.
Yeah. But I'm again, sure there are like ways. Said, if it's $7 million in ticket sales rather than $120,000 – is that, I mean, like, shit, somebody at Trees is pulling tens of thousands, maybe, right? I mean,
I bet a really good band in a venue like the Bomb Factory, which holds like 4,000 or 5,000, right, can make $100,000.
Yeah, $30 a ticket. Yeah, I mean, man.
Right.
That's crazy.
So they put together the show. They have their first performance of The Wall live in the Forum in Los Angeles. And the first thing that happens is, and I mean, how much of this did you watch? Did you watch, like, some of this show?
No, I watched the beginning of it and really relished the idea that someday in the future, after reading every Kurt Vonnegut book and every book by Philip K. Dick and all the other millions of things I've bookmarked on Spotify, this one's on that list somewhere of someday I will get to it. I just felt more like excited to know it exists. Like, just, oh, that's great. Right. You know, so.
So it is true performance art. First thing that happens is a guy in the U.S. It was a guy named Gary Yudman, who looks like he's just like a voice actor. He comes out and he's making announcements to the crowd. And the crowd is real rowdy. And the two of these that I've seen that are on YouTube, the crowd is amped up. They're ready to go.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, by the time the first show hits, The Wall has been released everywhere and is already a massive hit. So it's not okay. Like they're out there debuting new music.
Right,
like,
right. Okay.
This is an album that is a massive, massive hit right away. So this is, people know what they're coming to see. I don't know that they really understand they're coming to see the band enclosed by a wall. I don't think they had any way of knowing that. But they know they're coming to see The Wall because, remember, Pink Floyd always, when they would tour, they would basically play their entire new album, start to finish. Now, usually they would add in some older stuff. But they, you know, if you're going to see Pink Floyd tour The Wall, I think you at least knew that you were going to see The Wall.
Right.
Probably start to finish.
Right.
Especially that album, which doesn't really lend itself to, like, singles.
Right.
So Gary Udman comes out and he's making some very dry announcements to the crowd. And it's stupid things. Like, it's like the band is warming up and they'll be ready to go soon. There will be an intermission. Please go buy a t-shirt. Please do not use flash photography. if you're parked in a handicapped spot, please move your car so people will be safe. Please enjoy the show from your seat. Please do not stand throughout the show. It's just really dry, ridiculous announcements. And like in the middle of that, you hear the dudder and the show starts. They run him off the stage and the show starts. The first thing that happens in the first show is the fireworks that shoot up on those first notes catch a curtain on fire.
Holy shit.
At the top of the arena. Now that's some fucking
theatrics. Everybody's like, whoa.
So show number one, they have to stop the show to put the fire out.
In the first, like, few seconds.
Yes. Yeah. In the first show, they have to stop the show, like, at the very beginning to put a fire out. I have not found video of this, but did happen. And then, from what I can gather, 1,000,000,000 things could have gone wrong. And these shows largely went off without too many hitches.
Yeah.
And I've heard, you know, David Gilmour say, like, the first few shows were not fun because you just had, like, you had to stand here at this time and you had to stand here at this time and you had, like, there was no improvisation. Like, you had to be at certain places, hit your mark, say your line. You know, because that's how the show went.
Man.
And then he said after a few shows it got fun because you didn't have to think about it as much.
Right.
Like, you knew where you had to be, and it was a little bit looser and it was more fun. And then a few shows after that it got monotonous because it is the exact same thing every single night.
Right.
So as this show progresses, basically what they're doing is they're playing the wall start to finish. There is no encore. There is no money at the end or any of that stuff. It is the wall start to finish, and that is it.
Man.
And the first weird ass thing that happens is the show starts, and the band that's playing is not Pink Floyd.
Right. And they have masks on that make them look sort of like Pink Floyd.
They do, except for the lead singer, the Roger character, who seemed, from what I've seen, he's not wearing a mask, but he kind of looks like Roger.
Okay.
And he's got kind of long hair. He's wearing that kind of Nazi-looking jacket.
Sure.
And he kind of sounds like, or he's singing kind of like Roger. Or it might be Roger singing and this guy just lip-syncing. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Because to me, it always sounded like Roger, and I don't know the answer to that.
So, and they're talking about how they sent us in as like a surrogate band and all that kind of stuff, right? In the lyrics.
Yeah, they don't talk about the surrogate band until.
Oh, is that the later one?
Second, sort of the second in the flesh.
Okay.
Which is funny because when the show starts, I think it's really clear from the audience reaction, they do not know this is a surrogate band.
Right.
I mean, number one, Pink Floyd was a band that you never knew what they looked like.
Right.
They were pretty anonymous. I mean, hardcore fans certainly knew, but I mean, I think your average fan at these shows probably could not have looked at the stage and said, wait, that's not Roger Waters.
Right. Especially if you're not like within, for lack of a better term, spitting distance. That's a pun for our ardent,
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, that's a call back to Montreal.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying there. I like what you did. so they play the first In the Flesh song, and what you have is the wall is like partially built, right? It's built out to the edges of the seating area.
And there's like a V kind of shape that's not built kind of in the middle, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So the band is visible. The band is playing. And then at the very end of that song, when you hear the airplane noise on the album, you see an actual fucking airplane flying in from the top of the arena down towards the wall. And the airplane hits the top of the wall and explodes. And it's the craziest damn thing I've ever seen. And when Roger did this show, it's the exact same thing when I saw it. And it is jarring to see. And maybe it's more jarring after 9/11 when you see a plane hit a structure. Because that's kind of the first thing that comes to mind. And it maybe, but back then, I will maintain, even though I did not see every show in 1980.
Mostly because you weren't born for another year or two.
Correct.
Right.
But I will maintain, and from the accounts that you and I have both read, there was certainly nothing else even close to this.
Right.
This was so far beyond what anyone had ever attempted before.
Right.
That plane hits. The crowd is insane. The crowd's going absolutely crazy for this. They're eating it up. And it's not even Pink Floyd on the stage. It's just bizarro world. I'm sure if you're sitting there in the crowd and you're a fan of Pink Floyd, you bought The Wall, you like it. You're sitting there in the crowd going, holy fuck.
What the fuck is happening?
Like, yeah, you had to be, especially if you dropped acid before the show. Which half the audience probably did.
Right, right.
Man. You're like, oh man, what is happening right now?
Right.
Here's my takeaway from watching the first few minutes of that show. This show would be massively impressive if they did it exactly like that today.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Even with that same technology,
yep.
It would be like so far ahead of anything else today. You could bring back everything just like that.
Don't update it at all. 100%.
I mean, it would be unbelievable.
We talked about this a little bit in our very, very first episode of the show, and I think I wound up snipping it on the final version because we got so into the weeds. But, I mean, like, even massive bands today, you know, pass with, like, a couple of racks of lights, you know, 40, mm-hmm. 50 rented lights and, you know, a big backdrop that has their band logo on it. You know, massive bands can get away with that. And then there's, you know, there are bands, certainly U2 and Nine Inch Nails. And, man, I saw, I recently saw a Foo Fighters Back and Forth thing. And there's this part of, I think it was at Wembley, where they had an entire stage that was, like, somehow lights in the entire stage. It was insane. Like, just the production value was off the charts or whatnot, you know? And just seeing that, which was like a moderately simple concept or whatever, just blew my mind, which gives you a good, you know, like, I guess, yardstick of like, oh man, they got lights in the stage. That's extremely special. big TV screens and stuff are normal now and whatnot, but like, I mean, I don't know. Every Coachella show, it's like just Tom York, you know, from Radiohead just walking around on the stage with some, you know, a bunch of fog and you know, lights behind him, you know.
We've seen both. The Page and Plant show, that I count as one of the greatest shows I've ever seen, was literally just a stage and a few lights above them, and that's it. There was no backdrop. Yeah. There were no screens. Like, it was just Page and Plant up on stage and the crowd 100% behind them. I saw Metallica in the round. Like, they're in the middle of the arena, and there's no screens, there's no real, you know, stage setup other than the stage and the guys from Metallica, and it's one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But then you see this, and it's just, you know, listen, I love pizza, I love hamburgers. I don't have to decide which is my favorite. I like them both.
This is
so far beyond what you would see with any normal rock show. I mean, I've seen Paul McCartney. He puts on a great show, and it's a big stage show, but it's nothing like this, because this takes it from concert to, like, what would you call it? Like a art production, like a,
it's a Broadway production, and Broadway, I feel like, cheapens it. It's not like five, like, washed up actors, you know, sitting on stage trying to, like, pantomime out sets to get switched out or whatever. This is theater, no offense to Broadway, right?
I would put it beyond. I mean, performance art is the best thing I could say.
Right.
Kurt Loder called the final cut, like, art rock.
Right.
That's a genre unto itself, and I don't know who else falls in that genre, but this is clearly the king of that genre.
I'm pretty sure some bands like Flaming Lips seems like that might fit.
Okay.
Radiohead, probably. Just stuff that basically, generally speaking, as soon as you hear the band, you have a, kind of feel.
But what one thing that's different here is that I know that, like, so like Kiss, right? Very famous for their very elaborate show.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very theatrical. But
some very key differences. Number one, Kiss has never had a concept, and the one time they did with Music from the Elder, it was just universally laughed at.
Right.
So that was no good.
We got Mr. Roboto, the stage show with Styx.
Okay, so then you had Styx with Mr. Roboto, and everyone involved in that agrees that, like, yes, it was a big thing where there was, like, written dialogue, like, spoken dialogue during that show, and costumes, and it was, you know, I think tried to be similar to The Wall. And fans were, like, booing and walking out because they wanted to hear Blue Collar Man.
Right.
Whereas when you watch these shows, man, this crowd is into it. They are way into it. And Pink Floyd, I think, by that time had a level of respect where it was like, I think they could do anything.
Yeah.
And it would have been well received. And I've read a couple of accounts from people who were at these shows that said, like, yeah, I bought my ticket. I didn't quite know what to expect, but I liked The Wall. I liked Pink Floyd. And, oh man, for the rest of my life, I've been grateful I went to that show.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, 500,000 people total got to see that show. Now, I bet a million will say they saw that show.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
It's like Woodstock, right? There were 500,000 people there. There were 3 million that say they were there.
Right. Yeah. No,
so there's... I mean, as you go through the show, and, like, I'm not going to go through song by song, but it is a in the second song, the surrogate band, like, when the lights are down, kind of disappears, and here's Pink Floyd, and you hear the crowd reaction, like, they realize, oh, this is Pink Floyd now, like, they realize it's different people up there.
Okay.
And one thing that struck me about it is that in the first, you know, song is the Thin Ice. The second song is Thin Ice.
Yeah.
The first song where Pink Floyd is really playing.
Right.
And it's David Gilmour. And as soon as his first Mama Loves Her Baby, the crowd erupts. Like, they can hear, okay, that's Gilmour.
Right, right.
And then it cuts to Roger, and the spotlight hits Roger. Man, I know he describes himself as basically a miserable son of a bitch at that time, but man, he looks like he is having a blast. He is smiling. He's kind of dancing around the stage. He looks like he's having a great time. And I have a hard time understanding. None of us can understand, right? How is someone who seemingly is doing exactly what he wants and getting tons of accolades for it so unhappy?
Yeah.
He says he was unhappy. He looks like he's having an absolute great time.
Maybe he's a great performer.
Well, I think he's a better performer than what he gives himself credit for.
Sure.
One thing that you see, though, is he's wearing headphones. And
so being cut off from the world does make him quite happy.
Well, one reason for that is just due to the production. He wanted a click track in his ears.
Oh, yeah. He was basically the prototype for IEMs, right? I mean, now no band of any worth goes around in a stadium tour without both their ears plugged up with in-ear monitors, right? Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's like, I think I mentioned before, like, there's, like, a huge bootlegging community for, like, U2. And I don't know if these guys are doing basically radio piracy of, like, mm-hmm. Bono's IEM getting, you know, transmitted back to the sound booth or something or whatever. But there are bootlegs that are like, here's Bono's IEM mixed in with Edge's. You know, like, it's not even the soundboard recording. It's like this, you know, a crazy amount of shit. And it's like, yeah, what one of there's no in the stadium tour, you don't have Bono sitting there on getting close to a monitor on the stage, right? A big speaker pointing up at him. He's walking around everywhere, and there's no point of reference whatsoever for how he's sounding except for, you know, basically headphones, right? And for, you know, my dad's got some, like, Roger Waters era 1980s headphones, and that's just how, that's how they look. They were basically just made for air pilots, and that's what they were, and they weighed 10 pounds, and, you know. But, yeah, I'm sure he's not the very first person of all time to do that, but what he did there is, like, completely standard now. And click tracks and all kinds of, you know, tricks are going on. You know, I don't want to hear the Edge. I want to hear just the bassist, you know, or whatever. That's how I sing this song, you know, or whatever.
I saw Phil Collins. There's a documentary of Genesis starting a tour, and they're starting it at Texas Stadium. And Phil Collins is out there on the stage, like, that afternoon doing some final sound checks and stuff. And he shows the camera his ear monitor, and he goes, this is so that every night to me sounds exactly the same no matter where we're at. Like, and you can, like, he's like, that way I know. I don't have to, like, adjust to, like, wait, I hear too much echo. Wait, the guitar player is too loud tonight. None of that matters.
Oh, interesting.
If this is in my ear, to me, it's exactly the same every single night.
Huh. Yeah.
And he can nail it.
Right.
You know, and when you see the wall, I remember when Roger did it a few years ago, there was like a few people who complained that like, oh, the band is not totally live. Like they're using click tracks. And I'm like, you think everyone isn't doing that?
Yeah, no
like,
shit.
You think even like Tom Petty wasn't out there with some sort of guidepost?
Right.
Like you have fans now, especially paying like $100, $200, $300 to see this show. They do not want to see you fuck up.
Yeah.
Like they want to see
Ozzy's
it be good.
Been using a teleprompter for years.
Oh, everyone does that. You know, but McCartney.
It's like in the stage, and it's like, because you can't fucking remember all the lyrics, you know?
I remember sitting behind the stage one time at an Aerosmith show, and every single song was a teleprompter. Again, because why not? Like, yeah. Okay, you're Steven Tyler, and you just want to get it right. Like, yeah, you're going to do 20 songs tonight. Will you remember every single word?
Right.
Maybe you probably will, but if not, you can always glance down.
Yeah.
If you forget where you're at. Because why, again, you have 15,000 people that paid $100 to come see you play. Right. Just get it right. Yeah. They don't care if you're
It always
they don't
blows
care.
My mind, man, to think about that. These songs that you and I, like some of them, I'm not really good at this, but a lot of people can, like, just remember the lyrics off the top of their head. Every single word, you know, if you took the voice vocal track out, they can karaoke it without even looking at a teleprompter or whatever. And it just blows my mind when it's like, you know, your favorite artist ever and it's your favorite song ever. And they're like, when we were rehearsing, I had to relearn the song and I don't think I got it quite right. I don't remember what I did. And you're like, oh, my God, what? What?
Yeah.
You know, this incredible thing is basically lost to the sands of time, you know.
Yeah.
Blows my mind, but at the same time, I mean, I don't know. You know, take a conversation you had at work 2 years ago and try and remember how that went, just in general, right? I mean, that's what working in this business is like.
Well, I've even seen the guy from Styx, Tommy Shaw, say, like, he went back and listened to a couple of the, like, real classic songs that they play, like, went back and listened to the original recording, which he hadn't done in a long time, and he said he realized how far they had strayed from the original just through the years. Through playing it live over and over again.
Kind of improvising
then, you know,
a little here and
this
there.
This little thing changes. Then you go back to listen to the original and you're like, oh, wait a minute. We're not really doing it right anymore.
Yeah, that's
and
crazy.
And you have to fix it. Well, I mean, I think in this show, The Wall demanded it be perfect.
Yeah.
There was no option other than it had to be perfect. Because one problem is that The Wall is being built throughout the first half of the show. And the timing dictates that The Wall be completed at the very end of the last song of the first half.
Right.
So you had to get it right.
Goodbye Cruel World is happening, and they better have that last, be down to that last three bricks or whatever. I mean.
Good. Yeah, when he says goodbye, goodbye.
Yeah.
Goodbye. And right when he says that, the last brick goes in.
Okay.
And the lights go completely dark, and then the house lights come up, and it's 20-minute intermission.
Okay.
And that's it. A couple of things that I noticed in watching the first half of the show. Number one, the first part of the first few songs go through like really seamlessly. Like they all flow together, right? There's no break in between the songs.
Right.
And then you get to
that
Not
suite
Young
that
Lust.
Starts with like Empty Spaces or...
And you get to Empty Spaces, and that's where you have the animations on the screen for the first time.
So let me ask you this. The animations in the movie, were they made for this wall show? Were they made for both? Was it just the movie reused some? Because I think I've seen like some like vague memory photos, and it's like the same animations, right? Or some of them, at least.
No, I think I think they ended up using those animations for the movie.
Okay.
And they used them for the show.
Okay. All right.
And so the animations, like we've said, like it's like.
But yeah, it's like this multi-minute
like weirdly,
thing.
Like, it's like weirdly violently, like sexually, like these two flowers attacking each other.
Yeah.
And it's very strange. The crowd eats it up.
And,
you know, and Empty Spaces is not the same Empty Spaces that's on the album. This is the first time where it deviates from the album.
Okay.
Where Empty Spaces is like its own separate song that adds additional lyrics and an additional chorus. And now, it sounds more like a standard song.
Is that done in the movie as well? Or is it only if you get the Is Anybody Out There live
album? I haven't seen the movie in so long, I could not tell you.
Okay.
And the...
wait, is that the one that's like, have people for pets?
Yes.
People for pets? I believe so.
Yeah,
that is in the movie. I remember seeing that being like, dude, this version is so fucking rad, because it just has this like breakdown that is like...
Okay, so basically what I've read is that there were some stuff like that that they did for the album that they had to cut because they had to get the album. They just couldn't add another side to the album.
Right.
So there are some things that just wouldn't fit, but they needed it for the show because they needed time to build the wall.
Right. Interesting.
So it worked where they could add like this extra little musical piece to have more time to build the wall.
Right.
So then Empty Spaces ends and it ends. It doesn't go into Young Lust like it does in the album. It ends and Roger is like, welcome, good evening. Like, it's more like a standard concert at that point.
Right.
Which is very strange.
Okay, I got these lyrics. We got to read them. Because people, like, never heard them.
So okay, yeah.
So it has the, you know, what shall we use to fill empty spaces where we used to talk? How shall I fill the final places? How should I complete the wall? And that's what's on the, you know, that's what's on the record. And that's it. And then it's... it has this thing, and it's just like, it's really fast paced. I won't do it any justice or whatever, but it's like, you know, what shall we use to fill the empty spaces, you know, where waves of hunger roar? Shall we set out across a sea of faces in search of more and more applause? What shall we do now? Shall we buy a new guitar? Shall we drive a more powerful car? Shall we work straight through the night? Shall we get into fights? Leave the lights on at night? Drop bombs? Do tours of the East? Contract disease? Bury bones? Break up homes? Send flowers by phone? Take to drink? Go to shrinks? Give up meat? Rarely sleep? Keep people as pets? Train dogs? Raise rats? Fill the attic with cash? Bury treasure? Store up leisure? But never relax at all with our backs to the wall.
To the wall.
Man, it's intense. I remember seeing that in the movie and being like, the version on the album is bullshit. Where is this? You know?
You know, it is. It
man,
really
it's
is.
Awesome. And it's like a real like intense breakdown. I mean,
yeah, it really is. It's I enjoy that much more than the it's regular like, Empty Spaces.
Right. Yeah. It's like high energy. It's a totally different song.
Yeah, it's totally different, and it does not flow directly into Young Lust, like
right.
I said.
Yep.
But then you also get this thing where then it goes into Young Lust, and you can see, like, this is the first time Gilmour gets to just be David Gilmour.
Okay.
Like, he just hits those chords, and he rocks this song, and this is... I don't know if Young Lust was a hit yet. Like,
right.
I don't know if it was on the radio. Like,
right.
It was when I was a kid.
But yeah, but it's a rock song in general, man. I mean, it's like it's the first like traditional song. Well, I don't know, Mother's before that, right?
Mother, the crowd definitely knows.
Yeah.
That's one thing I noticed. The crowd knew most of this already.
Yeah.
Like, they had the wall.
Which
this
is crazy
because
I looked it up. It's three. Okay. It depends on where you're at. And if it's the one that's in Dortmund, just like a year later, that's fair. But the fucking LA shows and New York shows were 3 months after the record came out.
Dude, I think it came out in like December of 79 in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're talking like 2.5 months.
Yeah.
Maybe. Like,
and people
that's
are
insane.
Like, they know it inside and out, which I don't know, man. I definitely, when there were records that were basically that level for me, I knew them inside and out, you know, by the time
well,
that tour hit. But
you look at The Wall and it sold like a million copies within like a month or something, like something
man.
Ridiculous.
Right.
And you look at like the number one selling album of 2020, it was like Taylor Swift's album and it sold like a million copies total.
Yeah.
Because
right.
People don't buy music. They don't consume music in that way anymore.
Sure.
In this case, people bought The Wall and they went home and they put it on the record player and they listened to not just the singles, but they listened to The Wall.
Right.
And so the people coming to the show, I think they came to hear The Wall. I don't know that you could get away with this now. Like, I remember seeing Elton John, like, one time, and he came out, and the first 8 songs were from his new album, and people were bored to death.
Right.
Yeah. But no one had heard it. No one knew any of these songs. But this is just so different. It's just such a different time. You cannot replicate this now. No, there's no way you could do this now. No. Right?
Right.
So then it goes into the other songs, ends with Goodbye Cruel World. There's a funny, funny moment in the Nassau Coliseum show that's on YouTube where during Goodbye Cruel World, like just during that bass part, that doom, 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 mm-hmm. before he starts singing, someone yells, echoes!
Oh, no.
Because as the doom, do is happening.
Yeah.
Rick Wright is playing a ding on his piano to go along with it. And so someone yells, echoes.
Oh, no.
But the arena is totally silent except for this one idiot who's been, drinking his Miller Lite all night and thinks they're going to break out with echoes in the middle of the wall.
Oh, man. That's somebody's dad. That's a war story.
Oh, my God. Was that your dad? Was he in New York at that time? Was your dad in New York at that time? Are we sure?
Sorry, Dad. Oh, man.
So
it sounds like that's crazy. I didn't even make it to the damn airplane, man. I was like skipping around through it, just being like, I was in awe that like I was like, this video is 2 hours. Like, wait a minute, that's like the length of the show probably. And I just like skipped around and I saw like one section where like he's in the mocked up hotel room. I missed the thing you mentioned last time about like that by the time they start Hey You, they're behind the wall the entire time. So yeah, let's continue.
Let me take a quick break.
Sure.
Give me 1 minute. We'll come back and let's hit part 2 of this show.
Right.
Which is somehow more bizarre than part 1.
Sounds good. All right. I'll be back.
All right.
So
all right.
Yeah, we were talking about the wall's complete. And we're getting into Hey You, and you said the backside is like even crazier than the first half.
Well, it's just, I mean, number one, the wall itself, the album, gets weirder in the second half,
sure.
right? Because this is where the character Pink is in this like psychosis, right?
Right.
So it gets weird anyway. But what's weird, and this is where my dad, if you ask him about the wall, like when I told my dad I was going to see Roger Waters do the wall. He said, he goes, so do they do like the show behind the wall? And I said, well, part of it. And my dad just goes, stupid. he hates this idea.
Right.
That the like he doesn't understand the entire concept. He just knows that if the band is doing the show behind the wall, it is a very dumb idea.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And
it's art rock again, right? I mean, it's like not presumptuous. It's super pretentious,
Which is funny that he even knew that they did that,
right?
Because if you would ask him, he would say he's not really a Pink Floyd fan, but clearly he knew that that was a thing.
Yeah,
which I.
It's like the mythos
how.
Of rock or something, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's a mythical tour, man. This tour is very mythical. So the house lights go down for side 2 of the wall or, part 2 of the show, and the wall is fully built and you hear the first notes to Hey You, and you do not see anybody out front of that wall. And this show is just happening behind a wall. There's nothing. And you hear David Gilmour's voice. Then it kicks into Roger Waters' voice and all this is happening and you're just staring at a blank wall.
Are there projections on the wall and stuff or
not what from the 1980 shows? No. Now the Roger Waters shows. Yes.
Talk about Roger Waters smiling. I bet backstage in that part, he's smiling.
Yeah. So the Roger shows a few years ago. Yes. But the Pink Floyd shows from the early 80s, it does not appear there were projections on the wall during, Hey You. It is just a wall and the band is playing behind it. That's it.
Right.
It's bizarre.
Okay.
And that's the first time, in my mind, that's the first time that the crowd probably would have been sitting there like,
huh.
Okay, now what's happening?
Yeah, scratching their heads.
Yeah.
Is the show back on? I just got back from intermission. Man, this is a strong drink, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Did I take the brown acid?
Shit. Oh, man.
What's happening right now? So you have Hey You. And now then you have Roger does make an appearance. But this is a Roger Waters show at this point. I mean, yeah. This is like you have, Is There Anybody Out There? You don't see anybody.
Okay.
And then you have like...
how long does this go on?
But then you have Vera Lynn.
Okay.
There are projections on the wall during Vera Lynn. I don't know if Roger is outside the wall at this point, but there are projections. And it's funny. The technology change from now to then is very apparent, whereas back then there are clearly... three separate projections happening because that's all they could do from like that distance with that size. Whereas, you know, the wall today, it was like a, you know, full HD projection against the entire wall.
It was like, still three projectors, right? It was like fucking seamless. Like it was a miracle of technology.
I don't know how they did it now, but back then, no, it was three separate images. Like it was like three separate images on the wall at the same time.
Miniature TVs on the wall, just three basically, projectors. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have Nobody Home, and that's where Roger makes his appearance, where he is in a hotel room set. Like a little part of the wall pops out. And there's Roger sitting in a hotel room singing Nobody Home.
Now, this I've seen photos of, I'm pretty sure. He looks like pretty much the set that the movie has a little bit, right?
Okay, yeah.
Where the protagonist is kind of sitting in like, I don't know, it's a lounge chair, maybe it's not the right word, but like he's just kind of like leaned back a little bit right in front of a TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And...
again, you know how that, none of the rest of the band, nobody's come around the side in front, so you don't have like Nick Mason now as a drum kit out front. Everybody else is just completely missing in action?
Correct.
Okay.
You don't see anyone else in the band until Comfortably Numb.
Dude.
And then you have Bring the Boys Back Home, and then you have Comfortably Numb, and this is the legend of the wall to me. This is what I'd always heard about those shows.
This is the Rubik's Cube moment. This is most legendary... yeah. Rock and roll moment of all time.
Yeah.
David Gilmour getting ready to wow everybody, sitting there playing a Rubik's Cube backstage. How else are you going to get groupies? Answer me that. That's the power move.
I often stand on top of a wall in front of my house.
Yes.
For this reason. So you have Comfortably Numb starts after Bring the Boys Back Home. And Roger is out front of the wall wearing a doctor's lab coat, playing the role of the doctor. No instrument, no bass. It sounds
so cheesy.
He's just wearing a lab coat. Like, he's a character. He's an actor. That's why it's a Broadway show. Like, he is playing a character throughout the show.
Yeah.
People
are really concerned about their acid trip at this point. They're like, man.
Man. And then it kicks to Gilmour's part of Comfortably Numb. And one of the greatest, most legendary moments in fucking rock and roll history is the lights flash up to the top of the wall, and there's David goddamn Gilmour at the top of the wall doing his part. And you can hear it in the crowd. They're like, holy shit, that's awesome. And he does the show. And Gilmour said, like, he remembers some production guy, like, nervously asking him, like sheepishly, like, well, okay, what if you did Comfortably Numb from the top of the wall? And Gilmour was like, I think that's a damn good idea. Right. Sounds great.
Right.
It sounds like it was perilous, man. It sounds like this was not safe at all.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a quote I'm looking for real quick. Backstage visitors were often surprised by the understated normality of the band members. Despite the melodramatic performance being staged out front every night, one Earl's Court visitor was struck by the sight of David Gilmour eating sushi and toying with a Rubik's Cube during the interval, completely unfazed by the fact that just minutes later, he'd be perched on top of the wall playing a guitar solo in front of nearly 20,000 fans. The quote was, David doesn't do freak out. Like, man.
Yeah, what's amazing about all of this is that this is so much Roger's vision. And man, David just did it. He just went along with it. And he did it greatly. Like, he did it, like, I do think David is proud of The Wall. I think David Gilmour is proud of The Wall. I think he's proud of the show. I think he thought it was a good show.
Yeah.
I don't think he had much say. And David has said many times, he's very open about the fact that sometimes he was pretty lazy with his songwriting.
Sure.
With his ideas. Like he...
It's just not as fast. Like Roger is a very serious person. And I think that to some degree that comes across in the like... meticulousness of his music.
Oh yeah,
it's well, extremely also, when it's all the Roger Waters show, and I mean arguably like Dark Side of the Moon is very meticulous as well, like in general as like a piece that everybody kind of put together. But like, man, like you get like to the Final Cut and some of his solo records and stuff, and it's just like, man, like does this guy ever sleep? Like the anxiety racking this dude's body must be
off the
fucking charge. And Gilmour seems like a dude who is really chill, like as a personality.
Well, one thing you have with Roger is a like maniacal passion for the things that he's writing about.
Right.
And I don't think Gilmour has that.
Right. He has like a messianic kind of like, messiah complex, right? Of like,
yeah.
I am. Maybe it's like that he feels like he's blessed to make history or to, you know, wield a pen or something. And he doesn't waste any time. I mean...
No, Gilmour very much has a vibe of like, I'm going to let the game come to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Roger, of course, does not have that vibe at all.
Right.
Total opposite. So Gilmour is at the top of the wall during Comfortably Numb. It is a magical moment. You can hear the crowd in awe when you watch the shows. It's really, really incredible to see and hear. And it's one of those moments that you're like, my God, if I could go back in time, that might be one of the places I would go.
Right.
Like, that's definitely absolutely one of the things I would just give almost anything to be in the building for.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah,
so,
100%.
And then the rest of the show goes on, and it's, again, we're not going to go song by song. It does get, people do appear from behind the wall as time goes on.
But you can't leave us hanging here. Gilmour's on top of the wall. Does he hang out there after this? Does he disappear again, and then it's just Roger until the wall, like, comes down?
No, he disappears, I think, until you get to Run Like Hell.
Okay.
He sings on,
like they're playing backstage, right? It's not like a fucking
singing
reel to reel tape playing and just Roger dancing around. Like they're playing, they're just not in front of the wall.
No, he's singing. I think he sings again on The Show Must Go On, but that's not from on top of the wall. I don't know that you see him there. And then you have In the Flesh, and then you have Run Like Hell, where Run Like Hell is like. Now there are backup singers, there's Roger, and there's David. And even Gilmour at this point is, like, in costume. He's wearing, like, the Nazi-like emblem, or the Nazi-like emblem.
For the, like, In the Flesh kind of thing.
Yes, on his
shirt. Okay. All right.
So now even he's in costume at this point. So you see him. But the rest of it's pretty much Roger. He is in front of the wall for most of the rest of it. Not playing bass. He is like got a microphone and he's kind of pacing back and forth in front of the wall. He's pacing back and forth in front of the wall with all these projections on the wall. You have Waiting for the Worms, you have Stop, and then you have, of course, your favorite song, The Trial.
Of course. Wow.
And then at the end of The Trial, which has some of the most intricate animations.
Right.
Throughout, at the end of The Trial, where the judge orders tear down the wall. And you hear the tear down the wall, tear down the wall.
And eventually hear an explosion.
The wall starts to collapse. Like the wall literally, physically starts to come down. Like from the top down, the wall starts to get knocked down. And it's very dramatic. It's very kind of shocking to see. Because there's a giant wall that's been built throughout the entire show. And it's coming down. And they said like the first... Like the first time someone sees the show and they're in the first few rows, they're terrified. They think like these bricks are going to come down and hit them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they don't know what's happening. And it is, and I mean, seeing it live,
given that the first few seconds of the entire tour was burning a building down by accident,
yes.
I could see the concern.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even seeing it live today, knowing what was going to happen, it was still pretty jarring to see like this wall, like actually physically collapse and come down.
Wait, did they do that in 2011?
Yeah.
You're right. Like, it was like TV screens on the side. It wasn't the full... The Us and Them is when they had the full TV screen.
No, there were no TVs. There were no TV screens. There were projections on the wall. And when the wall collapses, it's only in the middle of the wall.
Right.
So the ends of the wall are still there.
You're right. Okay. For some reason, I keep getting confused with, like, you know, how that Metallica and U2 wall of late, you know, where it's like this 200-foot wide, like, LCD monstrosity. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Crazy. Yeah.
So you've got... The end
and,
of this
and
thing.
And that's it, right? This thing explodes. They sing.
Yeah, the wall
know.
Collapses. They come back out. They do the song Outside the Wall. Everyone comes out. Gilmore plays a ukulele. Yeah. Mason, I think, has a tambourine, and they do Outside the Wall. That's it. There's no encore. There's no time. There's no money. There's no Welcome to the Machine. None of that stuff. It's over. The show ends. And... I don't know. The shows, to me, I've never read any account of anyone being, like, disappointed by this. Like, these shows right. are pretty fucking legendary.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about the personnel, although in previous episodes we have. But basically, you had Rick Wright, who was fired during the recording of The Wall.
Right.
They brought him back to do the tour. I don't know exactly why. I mean, theoretically, they could have just replaced him. But they brought him back.
I've read that. Like, basically, it was like that was under wraps too, right? That he.
Correct. It was not public that they'd fired him.
Right, but I mean, given the thing we talked about earlier, where nobody knows who the fuck Pink Floyd is and what they look like, I mean, who the fuck is gonna know it's somebody else up there, not Rick Wright, especially when they're not in the first row. You know, I mean,
I don't know if I mean hardcore Pink Floyd fans certainly knew who Rick Wright was, so yeah, maybe it true. Did matter. I don't know, but they brought him back as a salaried employee, which means he was the only guy in the band who made money. The other guys lost their ass on this show.
Right.
It was just so expensive to put on. Now I see it, and I'm like, you sold out the Forum for like five straight nights. You sold out Nassau Coliseum for six straight nights or five straight nights. Couldn't you have found a way to make this work? Like, there was no way to make this thing profitable. Are you kidding me? I don't understand that. I don't understand the fact that there is such a high demand for anything and there's absolutely no way to make it profitable. Couldn't you have taken it to Chicago and played another five or six nights and then Dallas and then Phoenix? I don't know. I don't understand that at all, other than maybe Roger just didn't want to do that.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Sort of like he's still at his wit's end despite all of this. You know what I mean?
These
are the last shows they play as a group,
ever.
Right?
Correct. I mean, and so what I read was, and I think I mentioned this on the Animals segment, and I was wrong, because I thought this happened during the Animals tour, but it wasn't. It was during this tour where they were offered enormous sums of money to do this show at stadiums.
Okay.
And Gilmore and Wright and Mason seriously considered doing it without Roger.
Man.
Because Roger wouldn't do it. And they were like, let's just get the bass player from the Surrogate band. Because everyone thinks it's Roger anyway. This guy named Andy
Brown.
How
does that work? We talked about this last week where you got votes in the band. How does Roger outvote fucking anybody?
I don't know, but other than they decided not to do it. It doesn't sound like they really pushed it and he vetoed it. It sounds like they thought the better of it and decided not to do it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just for the sake of not blowing up the band, because they probably would have known that, like, that would have been it. Right.
Right.
Like,
that's true.
There's no coming back from that.
Right. And the actual blow up comes several years later. Right.
Correct. So,
I mean, I don't know. Wright's out. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. At this point, they decide not to go ahead and do that. And that's it. The Wall is over. They do the movie. I don't have much to say about the movie, but the Wall tour is over, stored away, never to be seen again in that form. Until Roger staged it years and years later on his own.
In 2011, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So
I got some facts and some notes I wrote down for various things.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff, like, you know, the wall apparently is 450 bricks. It was, like I said, like each brick is 5 feet wide by 2.5 tall. So it's like a man's body size for each one of these things. What's weird, though, is, like, there's 450 of them, 33 feet tall, right? So three stories tall, right? 260 feet wide. They're only 1.5 feet deep. I would completely understand seeing the depth of those things and being one of those people on the front and feeling like it's going to fall at any minute. 33 foot tall, built piece by piece, little shitty tour road ready to pack into an 18-wheeler little boxes. That's weird. That's intimidating. 450 of them. Man, that's crazy.
That's insane.
Let's see. We talked about them having to change their running order and drop a track on the actual record. Gilmore had a 6 foot long cue sheet. And this is where I got that thing I was talking about earlier. He worked on the cues order for everything, all the logistics of what happened on stage. So, like, you're saying, hey, you need to be on this riser at the beginning of this. When the first note of Goodbye Blue Skies hits, you need to turn this way. All this insane stuff. All analog. No digital cues. No computers. So when that tape starts running, if you guys start getting off, it's complete, you know, nightmare. Every frame of animation took one day for one person to make. Let's see. I do have some stuff about the film, but I mean, I think that's it that I've got really about the wall thing. I mean, my favorite part of all of it is Gilmore playing the Rubik's Cube, like just in the middle of waiting for his cue, like just hanging out backstage, you know, doing a crossword, basically.
So this wasn't in the book that I read. This is just on Wikipedia, so I don't know where it came from, but I buy it that things in the band were so bad at this point that behind the arena at every show, they had four Winnebagos in a circle, all facing away from each other.
Right.
I don't know why that fucking matters. Like, you're in your trailer. That seems like an odd detail to add that they were facing away from each other.
Right.
But they had their four trailers all outside, all where they were not visible to the other when they walked out their front door. At these shows, which is important because you're there for a week, basically.
Yeah.
So, like, that's your home for a week.
Yeah.
While you're at these shows, they wanted nothing to do with one another.
I can start to see how this is, like, not fun. But, I mean, my opinion in general, I mean, now I'm a 40-year-old, and I guess they were close to that, right? Mid-30s by this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that. Yeah.
Like, my opinion, like, a tour would be something you want to, you know, get wrapped up and get done. I cannot believe, like, I mean, U2 is just doing it. I mean, they literally do it for charity. I think that last tour, I sent you some stuff a few weeks ago that I was looking up. Maybe it was the Joshua Tree tour. I think there's even been one since then or whatever. But multi-year tour, like just dates, like nonstop, correct, you know, maybe a month off out of 2 years of like basically being at your own home or whatever they wind up doing. And, you know, sometimes there's like a couple of days off, but it's like just it's for the love. And I don't know, you know, these guys are all married and stuff and maybe there's groupies, maybe there's not or whatever. But like, man, you really got to like travel and just sitting in a bus a whole bunch as a lifestyle. And I can't imagine living in a freaking Winnebago. That's, you know, I think about that too. You know, Tom Cruise is crazy, right? Or Brad Pitt, you know, goes off the deep end for whatever reason or something at some point. It's like, yeah, dude, like 3 months, 4 months out of the year, those guys are sitting in a fucking Winnebago in like the middle of the Arizona desert trying to shoot the desert scene for the third day in a row. You know,
I can't believe that, like, okay, they're in New York. Surely they had hotel rooms as well.
Right.
But you got to get up in the morning. You got to go to the arena and do your sound check. And you got to be there for most of the day. So that's your space, right? Your Winnebago that you've got behind the arena.
Right.
That's your home for most of the day.
Right.
It's not like you can go sightsee in New York the day of a show.
That's true.
So that's your refuge. I doubt they were sleeping there, but that's your space for the day. So,
yep.
Either way, it sounds like tensions were high, and it sounds like this was absolutely the Roger Waters show. I don't think the other guys had much of a say in what was happening. It was bigger than any of them. And I think from my standpoint, if you look at the legacy of it, I would call it a massive success.
Right.
I don't think you'd call it anything else. The movie was a disaster.
And they, like, didn't they lose money except for right on this thing or whatever? So if you're just going by financials and stuff, not necessarily successful. But, like, man, like, name another rock movie that doesn't make you laugh intentionally that's awesome. Right? Like, Spinal Tap mm-hmm. is the other rock movie, in my personal opinion, that's awesome. And, mm-hmm. You know, The Wall is, it's an incredible movie. It's haunting. It's very moving, you know. It's a difficult thing to slog through just because of how dark, I guess, it is and stuff. But, like, man, yeah, I think that, like, in terms of, like, iconic, I think is the word we're looking for. The whole wall, everything to do with it, just iconic. Like, Dark Side of the Moon almost feels like an accident compared to this. And we talked about this a little bit with Wish You Were Here, right? Where it's kind of like Dark Side of the Moon happens. They've been doing okay with metal and some of the other stuff. And they're, you know, I mean, they can get name checked. People know who they are. Dark Side of the Moon happens. And the first thing people are going to say when you have mega success is, well, you got lucky, you know? They come out with Wish You Were Here and do even better. And, like, it doesn't sell quite as many millions and millions of stuff, but it is a solid, iconic record just the same. And at that point, like, we talked about this a little bit, maybe they kind of phone it in for Animals. It was a couple of long tracks that were meant for Wish You Were Here that they kind of, like, scrapped and then came back to and stuff. And then, man, Roger, with this Wall project and stuff, it's a multi-year, it's like a half-decade dedication thing. It's a year of recording it. It's a year or something of all that same time preparing for the show that's going to happen. The movie doesn't come out until 82, 83 or something. That has a whole different level of, you know, problems with it, getting it all together and all this kind of stuff. Like, this was, I don't know if he knew it or not, but this is like Roger's, like, going out with a bang. Like, this is it. This is the biggest thing of his life. And I don't know, 1,000 years from now, is Wikipedia going to say Dark Side of the Moon is it? Maybe, but The Wall is, there's nothing like it, man. Yeah. I mean, there's so many, like, since it's so iconic that there's so many fucking imitators that have tried to do it after, you know? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, like I said, like, you had, like, Styx do the Mr. Roboto tour.
Right.
And it was a joke.
Right.
Like, it was such a joke. It's still a joke today. Like, right. People joke about how stupid that was.
Well, and it's so pretentious, and it's so crazy that this, like, I think it's also crazy that this is successful, because, like, when you're talking about it to me, about how it goes, I'm just sitting here, like, rubbing my temples of, like, seeing Roger Waters in a fucking doctor uniform prancing around on stage. I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is peak parody. This is like Spinal Tap. Half of the movie was written about.
If I gave you this in a pitch meeting, I'm like, right. All right, guys, here's my idea. You would fire me. Like, this would be the end of the. But I have a tremendous respect for Roger Waters. I think the guy is at a next level genius.
Yes.
Type level.
Right.
And, you know, not that he can do no wrong, as we'll see in his solo years.
Right.
Because he certainly can.
And we see in the trial, obviously.
He is certainly, well, I think the trial is fantastic. But if you surround him also with the right people, like Gilmore or Bob Ezrin, who can work to, like, kind of soften the sound just a bit.
Sure.
Then it works. And somehow it does not come across as parody like so many of these other concepts do. And that's incredibly hard. You know, we've talked a lot about Metallica and how, like, how are they almost 60 still playing metal music and they don't look or sound like Spinal Tap?
Right. Yeah.
And this is the magic of Roger Waters. How does he do this? How does he sing about World War II in 1980?
Right.
And then stage basically a Broadway production about this fictional character that's kind of like him, but kind of like Sid Barrett and all that. And how does he do that? And it does not come across as like super pretentious and parody.
Right.
It's incredible.
I guess it does to some degree. I mean, part of the...
It is pretentious. Oh, it's very pretentious.
Well, no, but it actually comes across that way to some degree, because like there's definitely like the punk movement has been going around by this time at a little bit. That's one of the things about the movie. The guy who like was in it was this Bob Geldof guy. He was in his own band, and it was kind mm-hmm. of that kind of like punk roots thing. And he fucking like hated Pink Floyd. The whole concept...
Yeah, he was not a Pink Floyd fan. That's right.
They were the
That's
last right. like... You know, one of the last big mega rock bands. You know, after this, you get Guns N' Roses and you get Poison and some of these other ones that take the like real kind of hard rock, you know, banner. And they're like, it's all parties, you know, it's all good times and heartbreaking. And it's just it's mostly it seems like shallow as a, you know, as a theme, you know, this real yeah. dark, deep, introspective shit that Pink Floyd's doing is like it's. You know, and like you said, how is it not self-parody at that point, where this is like 1981? I mean, it's like as if Nirvana came out with something today and like it just shook the world. Like, can you imagine? You know, no way. Or Metallica. Metallica's a better example. They're still around. Or U2 is a good one. These are titans of rock. Can you imagine them releasing yeah. something now and it being like, this is world-changing? Fuck no. Not at any capacity, no matter how much they try. I mean...
We do not, as Americans, we do not have the capacity or the attention span anymore to yeah. really delve into something like this. Right. The best examples now might be like more like podcasts. Like remember when Serial was a big thing?
Yeah,
like
right.
People talking about Serial, right? And which was a big ordeal. Like you had to undertake like 8 episodes
to be able to talk to your predominantly white friends who also right. listen to NPR between all the episodes. Yeah,
correct. Right. So you right. like maybe that's the best example of where this type of thing happens now, but it does not happen in music now.
Right. Yeah,
it just doesn't. Right. Miniseries. Maybe there are some miniseries out there that really capture our attention. But in music, this is impossible. Yeah,
attention
today.
Spans for music is dead.
I don't know how you could do this today. I don't think yeah. you could. You could try it, but it wouldn't be consumed in the same way. Because again, back then you couldn't go to Spotify and pick and choose the songs you want to hear. You had to buy yeah. the album, just drop the needle, and listen to the album.
Yeah, and if Pink Floyd said, which they did, you're not releasing this as a single, then you didn't get a single, and there's single of Comfortably Numb, you know?
And they did release, like, Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, but yep. on a record, I don't know, man, how do you buy a record? Like, you've dealt with a record before, having to drag that needle over just to that song, like, it's a pain in the ass.
It's the same thing as you and me just knowing, you know, track 3 on Load is this song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you get adept to it. You can, if you've got a vinyl in front of you, you can kind of see which tracks are longer and shorter based on like how much of the thickness between the track jump marks are and stuff. I'm sure. But at the same time, repeat definitely is something that never happened. You never had that CDs made that thing. And even, you know, Walkman that could play a cassette and just keep looping it back and back, and someone being able to dub their own cassette and stuff. I mean, there's so much about music listening today that is totally different and like just alien to this time frame, right?
Well, I think of like a band like Phish.
Right.
Like there's one song from Phish that I really like called Farmhouse.
Okay.
And I can go to Spotify and I can listen to Farmhouse whenever I want.
Sure.
Sometimes you're in that mood. I'm going to listen to Farmhouse. You go to it. If I didn't have Spotify, I would have bought that album.
Got
and
it.
I absolutely would have listened to that album start to finish.
Yeah.
And instead what I did was I went to Spotify one time and I started that album and I was like, good nah. Lord, this is fucking terrible. This sucks.
Yeah.
Like after like the first song, I bailed on it. If I'd made the investment to buy the album, I would have absolutely at least given it a full listen.
Right.
To see, oh, this band, this one song I really love and people like this band, I'm going to give it the whole album. But the barrier to entry is so much easier now that I can bail on it and not lose anything.
Right.
Except for the minute that I spent listening to this first song that's just awful. But I just can't imagine any band that I've really ever been into going out on tour, playing their entire new album.
Nothing
and
else.
Only that. There is no encore.
Right.
Even when Roger announced his Wall tour a few years ago, the morning after the first show, I punched up the set list to be like, all right, what else does he play? Like, even I was so naive as to think, like, maybe he would end it with something else.
Yeah, that's funny.
And there's like, nope, it's the Wall. It's the Wall start to finish, and that is it. And that's all they did back then. And there was nothing else. And I cannot think of any other example of a band. Legacy bands will do that, right? They'll play the Eagles will play Hotel California start to finish.
Yeah, but again, it's like, it's a 30-year-old record that everybody wants to see.
Correct.
I think Red Hot Chili Peppers had a double record, which to me sounds abhorrent. Stadium Arcadium. God.
That sounds terrible. Oh, man. Oh, that sounds awful. Yeah. Not interested.
Not interested. An episode you guys will hear.
No, for sure.
Okay, this is interesting. Rush, half of this list, I've mentioned the hundreds of albums I've been passing through. Rush has quite a few of them. Let me know if these are records or they're like just, you know, B-side collections. Okay. All the World's the Stage?
Yeah, that's a live album.
Okay, Exit Stage Left?
Mm-hmm.
Live album?
Pretty sure that's live, yeah.
Okay, they all are probably. A Show of Hands, Chronicles, Vapor Trails?
No, Chronicles is, I think, a compilation. Vapor Trails, that's a bona fide, like, in the studio, new recorded album.
Yeah. There's like four more. Gold, Snake and Arrows.
Okay, so Clockwork Angels.
Yeah.
Is that on there?
Yep, that's on there.
Okay, so here's the thing. I did see Rush the one time I saw them, and there's a episode idea that we have for worst shows we've ever seen. Not worst shows, but most disappointing shows we've ever seen.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And this is going to be on that, because it was like they played that entire new double album, start to finish. But at the end of it, they did play Spirit of Radio. They played Tom Sawyer. They still played their hits.
Yeah.
In fact, they opened it with like a handful of like classic hits.
Yeah.
Then they played their entire new double album, which was, listen, you know Rush.
It's not a hard listen. Honestly, which it seems like a blessing, but yeah.
Okay, it's a hard listen. Like the songs you don't know, it's
a
hard
listen.
I know that
part of it, yeah.
Right. Not a lot of hooks in those songs.
Right.
But they still closed it out with some stuff that like you knew. That's what's so amazing to me about The Wall. No, they were like, fuck that. None of that. We're playing The Wall. Start our brand new album, start to finish, and that is it. Nothing else.
Yeah.
But it was big enough and well respected enough. Even then, I've never heard anyone complain that this was like not a good idea.
Right. Yeah. That's crazy. I mean, it's an amazing thing to accomplish. It's an amazing thing to accomplish, like you said, without like being like self-parody, just like completely like just the butt of every joke for the rest of time of like, you know, the most pretentious, silly thing of all time.
Yes, it's unbelievable. Like, I feel like Dave Grohl like walks on this line at all times.
Yes, exactly.
Of being like the cool rock and roll guy, but also like he tries too hard to be the cool rock and roll guy.
Right, yeah.
Like, and he's on the cusp of being a joke at all times, but he just kind of stays right on that line.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
He's brilliant at walking that line.
Right, right. I think Tool's another good example where like people give them a lot of, and Radiohead's another one. Radiohead is like even more than Dave Grohl. I sometimes get the impression this is a band that these guys are like losing their mind, Roger Waters style, and trying to like exit. You know, they're like trying to like not be bigger and just, you know, whatever, like fuck off in the studio. It's famously a band that at this point, it doesn't matter, especially now that music has collapsed in terms of making money off of what you record. What you record is going to be free, basically. You're going to make no money back from doing it. And still, they do once in a while. And it's a long, arduous process when you're as pretentious as that. You know, to Dave Grohl's credit, at least it's still just pop songs. And it's just him and his friends hanging out and making some songs, you know, for a few months once in a while. You know,
right.
Yeah.
No, it is really impressive how Pink Floyd avoided that at the time.
Yeah, and they make that it's not a great movie, you know, cinematically. It's got a lot of really cool stuff in it and stuff, but it's like, it's just, I guess plotting would be the way I'd say. It's just, it's, you got to be into it. You got to have it to listen to the music, and basically it's a long-ass music video. It's not a movie.
Okay, so you have the concept of, like, leave the crowd wanting more. Right. Instead of wanting less.
Yes.
And that's where Roger probably went wrong with the movie.
Right.
Which it was like, no one really wanted the movie.
Yes.
Like, the album, the tour, as limited as it was, like, that seemed to be enough.
Right.
Definitely. And the movie, and I've seen the movie, and it was a long time ago, but I've never, as much of a Pink Floyd fan as I am, I've never felt compelled to see the movie again.
And you only seen it once?
I might have seen it with you when we were like
probably in high school. Yeah, no, man. Back in high school, I was watching it a lot. It was like one of my most favorite.
You seem like the kind of kid who did. You seem like the kind of kid who watched it a lot.
Right. Sitting there listening to Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. Okay, that's 2.5 hours. Then watching The Wall. That's 1.5 hours. Listening to The Wall. That's another 2 hours. Listening to The Fragile all the way through. That's Saturday, man. I don't know why I didn't have a lot of friends back then. I had busy shit going on.
Wait, what? How did you have time for all that in between all the times you were getting laid during that time?
That wasn't a problem, contrary the rumor mill, yeah. Yeah, big surprise. Kid listening to Melancholy and Infinite Sadness not getting laid a whole bunch. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's shocking. Man. I don't know.
Shocking. Yeah, I did. I liked it a lot. And, like, I think I hate to troll you, but, like, part of the reason I liked it a lot is what I saw before that was Tommy. And I was my God, what the fuck? This stuff is so bad. Like, so Spinal Tap is the only music, music kind of based movie that's ever going to be good. And it's because it's completely parody. And I saw The Wall, and like, I got a handful of movies that it's kind of like your Donnie Brasco situation. Like, man, no matter how campy they get over time and whatever, I can watch Empire Records, I can watch High Fidelity, I can watch The Wall, I can watch Spinal Tap, and a couple others that are escaping me at the moment.
Sure.
At any time, and be like, I watch this. This is great. This is just, I don't know about nostalgia or what it is, but I'll watch it. And The Wall is like the only one that now that I'm older, I'm like, man, whew. This is an emotional burden to watch this person like rip apart and then try and like take all their shit out on the world, and it's a heavy fucking message, you know.
So that's probably the next place to go is to dive into the movie, and there might not be much of a dive.
No, maybe.
Just to say that they did make a movie. It sounds like it was a completely Roger-driven project. This was. Like
in terms of the band, right? But the animator guy actually had a lot to do with it too.
Gilmore was not really involved.
Oh yes, yeah, 100%.
In the movie, this was a Roger Waters joint project, 100%.
Yeah.
And I do remember some things about it that did stand out that I really enjoyed, like the kids all going into the quote factory of the school and then coming out all looking exactly the same. That did stand out.
Yeah, it has the iconic imagery, 100%. Like no question.
Yeah,
I mean that music videos after. This what's weird is like I think MTV debuted in like 80 or something, right? I mean, this was like the music video to end all music videos, in my personal opinion. Every trope that's ever been done in a music video since and stuff is trying to touch some bit of like every emotion that this hour and a half music video hits, in my personal opinion.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. But, you know, bottom line is it did not connect at all with people, with the public. Like, it did not really hit a chord.
For whatever reason, performed like dismally and basically became like one of those kind of cult classic movies at best. Yeah,
absolutely. It turned into something that like people who are really into Pink Floyd, they watch. People who are not have no idea that it even exists.
Right, exactly. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say just I think it relatively from a critic standpoint seems to be pretty much panned.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Does anyone have... I watched actually a Siskel and Ebert review of The Wall.
Okay.
If you knew this existed. It does.
Okay.
They kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Interesting. They kind of thought it was pretty good.
And their opinions on Tommy?
Well, they did not review movies at that time that Tommy came out. They Fair probably enough. Would not have liked it.
Yeah.
And it is different. I mean, it, you know, I can say The
Tommy,
Wall...
Tommy is very humorous, right?
Yeah, Tommy's different. Like, it's about a deaf, you know...
Deaf, dumb, and blind kid who plays pinball.
Pinball. Yeah. Like, yeah. It doesn't really relate to literally anybody, right?
Right.
The
right.
concepts on The Wall relate to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
so, quite different. But no, like, I remember Siskel and Ebert, like, they kind of thought it was pretty good. They liked it.
Yeah. Let's see. I got some factoids. I don't got a ton, but...
Okay.
Hey You sequence was made for the film, but it's cut, but it's on DVD extras. I did not know that until this last week. Mm-hmm. It's got to be on YouTube. If it is, we'll link it in this podcast episode description. That's pretty cool. Okay. They cut it because it had basically reused footage from other parts of it. And there's already a couple of montages towards the end that are kind of these callback sequences showing, you know, things you've seen in the movie, like flashback style and whatnot. So maybe it was similar to that. Again, I can't really comment because I haven't seen that. But that's out there, which is kind of interesting. They reworked songs for the film. Like you were saying earlier, that whole empty spaces thing, I totally forgot about that. Like, the people as pets line in particular, like, the way they deliver it, where they're, like, you know, just, like, this murderous, like, call out on society and all the ills of it and stuff. Like, it is so fucking good. And I was like, why is this not on the album? And it turns out they reworked a lot of songs for the film. Like, they even re-recorded some parts. There's things that are a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. There are things that have some alternate lyrics sometimes. There are little interludes, like famously, I think, when the tigers break free, which wound up being on the final cut, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's in there, and I remember hearing that and not knowing about the final cut. Go ahead.
It actually wasn't even on the original final cut. It wasn't on the final cut until Roger re-released it a few years
interesting.
Ago.
I was wondering about that, because I hastily remember as a kid in the late 90s being like, man, this was released only as a single on a record or something, and like never been released since. And then recently I was listening to the final cut, and I was like, oh, man, I must really be misremembering. That's interesting. Okay,
awesome. When I listen to the final cut now, it's kind of jarring to hear it in the middle of what I know as the final cut.
Interesting.
It's like George Lucas redoing Star Wars.
Right.
It's really weird. It's like, this is not the album that I know and love. Like, I like the song, but it's just different than how I had always heard it before.
Right, right. So there are bootlegs out there, and or you could just rip it yourself, which is something I did at a young age as soon as I learned how, which was also at a young age, where you could rip the stuff from The Wall. And like, since there's very little actual dialogue in it, and the whole, you know, the Wall actual record is the same, where it's like got dialogue throughout it and stuff, you can kind of rip the entire movie soundtrack and you've got like a different version of The Wall in a lot of different ways. It's really, really cool. And I mean, that's a heavily bootlegged thing. That's a thing that like it's a thing people do, because it's just like this alternate version of this iconic record in a lot of different ways. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. They actually, and I will get into it with the final cut and stuff, but they had pieces that were left over from The Wall that made it into the movie, and then ultimately some of them made it to like the formation of the final cut, the next record and stuff. But it was like they had to cut some, like a couple of tracks just from the record in general, just to fit it into 40 minutes. And I think Empty Spaces, like you mentioned, that awesome ending to it and stuff was one of the things that went, which I can't, man, I just cut like half of the 20 minute trial song and put that back in, you know, my personal opinion.
Yeah.
I mentioned Bob Geldof. He was like he was in a band. It escapes me. Something Rats.
The Stray Cats.
The Stray Cats? Okay.
Or the Boomtown Rats.
Boomtown Rats. Yeah, same thing Boomtown as Stray Rats. Cats. Those guys all hang out in the same alley. Okay. Which was like a punk-ish kind of band or something. I don't know. And he, Roger, like, had to, like, court him multiple times. And he He's perfect, in my opinion. I don't know a lot about him. He seems like he's a little bit of a jerk to some degree. I think in a previous episode, you told me about... No, I don't think it was you. I think Jane dug this up, that Michael Hutchence of INXS famously, like, committed suicide after having a conversation with this dude.
Okay.
He had kids and why, and he had kids with this lady that ultimately wound up divorcing him or something, and marrying Bob Geldof. Anyway, it's a like a tragic story and stuff. And like one of the last conversations that guy from INXS had was with this dude, some kind of spat that was going on about visiting the kids or not, or some kind of shit. So that's wow. hanging on this dude's head, which kind of makes sense for all the Live 8 and Live Aid stuff. The dude's got a bunch of karma to catch up on, it sounds like, but he was not into Pink Floyd. He didn't want to do this. And somehow right. he came around to it. I don't remember it being like a super sweet story of how he came around to it and stuff. I think at the end of the day, he still didn't even really like his performance in it and stuff like that. But I love it, man. He is like a, and I mean, I think it's great that he was so fucking argumentative about doing it and not, and so outspoken and stuff. What, talk about a fucking yeah. Roger Waters, who's not Roger Waters on the screen. I mean, just,
no, I like, you know, they didn't get like a Pink Floyd fanboy.
Yeah,
to do the movie.
And the dude, like, that dude oozes rock and roll. Jesus Christ. On that screen. Like he is the dude that, like, every prototype for rock and roll I've ever thought in my life since seeing that is like, that's the guy. That is the quintessential rock and roll person and what they go through and stuff. Anyway, yeah, I liked it for that regard. Let's see. You know, like you mentioned, nobody was involved except for, nobody's involved except for Roger and the guy who was the animator. He had a lot to do with it too and stuff.
Okay. There was like a
battle of apparently with film, it's a little bit like you can't always get the shot. You plan your best, but you just don't always get it or whatever. And so you just do your best. You plan, you shoot multiple times and all this kind of stuff, but you just can't have the level of perfection that Roger could get in a studio endlessly cutting up tape. You're trying to cut tape and video, it just doesn't work that way. It's not the same thing. Right. It's not as easy, and it's astronomically more expensive to try and even do something to that level. Mm-hmm. They had Roger, he wasn't even on the set. He wasn't even allowed on the set, or they sent him basically on vacation or something during the entire like 1 or 2 month shooting period or whatnot. In retrospective, he said that one of the major faults of it was that he kind of lost the humor that came along. And I think that that's a good slag in general on the wall, I think, is that I feel like Wish You Were Here, right? Have a Cigar is like the ultimate Pink Floyd send-up of humor and sarcasm and stuff. And they're like glimpses of it. On animals, and you know, animals like, you know, sheep is a good example, and pigs. There's parts in it that are ruled like mocking and stuff, but it gets darker and darker and darker. And the wall is like not quite the bottom, because wait, there's the final cut is still coming and stuff. But I think that's a good like self identified kind of issue with what the movie especially suffers from. It never lets up, man. Right from the beginning, you're like, what the fuck is going on? This mm-hmm. guy is in a bad way, and it just gets worse and worse and worse, and ends with a kid, like I mentioned in the last episode, fucking finding a Molotov cocktail on the ground while he's trying to clean up stuff and put stuff in a wagon in the middle of like some bombed out rebel city or whatever. It's just it's well, brutal, man. It is not a
I
fun
do
thing.
I think the wall is, you know, you mentioned like Have a Cigar, where it's all still kind of fun.
Yes.
Like we're just making fun of this.
Yeah.
We're having a good time. Right.
We're not talking this about Nazis and like, you know, the Final Solution, you know, I mean,
no, but in the wall we are.
Yeah.
Like in the wall, like in the wall, it's like,
and we're talking about like violent spats with groupies and wives and stuff and cheating on people like very overtly and stuff. And it's like, man.
Yeah. Geez. In the wall, it's like, okay, we're done fucking around.
Yeah,
like this shit is real, and
it's all politics.
It is quite different. There's a writer slash podcaster that I really like, Malcolm Gladwell, and he did a podcast series, and one of the one of the episodes he did was about parody and comedy.
Okay.
And how parody and comedy without courage really doesn't mean anything. And he cited like how, you know, SNL like parodied Trump leading up to the election, but then they had him host a fucking show. Basically saying, like, elbowing him, like, haha, aren't we all just having fun here? Isn't it just a good time? Like, it was parody without courage.
Right.
Whereas the parody with courage would be ending it by saying, no, fuck you, Donald Trump. We fucking hate you.
Exactly.
Like, that would be the courage, right? Right.
And here's a good example. This wall definitely is the same thing where it's not
100%.
It has the courage. It doesn't end you. It doesn't leave you with a happy ending, right?
No, not at all. No, yeah. There's no, there's certainly no happy ending. There's no, there's no reason to believe that there's a happy ending. And there's no reason to believe that this is all just a happy disagreement.
Yeah.
It's like there's right, there's wrong, and this shit was fucking wrong.
Yeah.
And you can argue it. You can argue that that maybe Roger is dwelling too much on these things.
Right.
Okay, that's fine. How would any of us feel if we lost our dad? I think we would all feel in a pretty similar way.
Right.
But no, I think this is the end game. Now, I would argue the final cut is the real end game.
Sure.
Where it's like, okay, this character of Pink is gone, but also there's still some really bad stuff happening.
Right. Yeah, so, like, okay, that's great, guys. We did talk about World War II. Let's drive it home. The problem with the World War II is that nothing is better today. We're still doing the same old shit.
Correct.
We're still humans, right? Now, I think we get a major ego boost, maybe even not from the movie. We get a major ego boost doing this 5-year project of this double record / you know, moderately successful tour, at least iconic tour, and still definitely cult classic iconic movie. And what's going on? Is Gilmore and everybody else like just, I mean, Wright is not in the band. He's fired by this point? What's going on?
Yeah, so Wright did the Wall tour. He was paid a salary, just as a salaried employee. Was not a part of the band anymore because he'd been fired.
Right.
Or he'd technically quit because Roger told him to quit.
Sure.
And he said he did the tour because he was hoping if he did the tour well enough, Roger would bring him back. And Roger did not bring him back.
Right.
And I don't think that was an indictment of how he performed on the tour. I think Roger was already done with him.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Roger has these songs that did not quite make it onto the wall.
And they were called like Loose Bricks or something.
Spare Bricks.
Spare Bricks. And they were going to release, I forgot to mention this, they were going to release a soundtrack with the movie. And I'm not sure if it was all the re-recorded Wall or whatever or something, but basically it wound up being just When the Tigers Broke Free, plus, I don't know, maybe the other version of Empty Spaces. I'm not remembering what the B-side was, but it was basically a single, you know, on a vinyl record that was it. And this, I think that like there was stuff, I'm just talking off hazy memory now, but I feel like there's even promotional materials when the movie came out of like, hey, and the soundtrack is out now on blah, blah, blah records. And it was going to be, you know, I don't know how much of it or all of it, but like it was going to be, you know, a substantial amount of the version of the Wall that was in the film. But that didn't happen. And When the Tiger Broke Free, for example, was one of those songs that's kind of out there. And you said that didn't even make it into the final cut originally.
Yeah, so basically what happened was you had this is incredibly Roger Waters of this to happen. So you have Spare Bricks. And the idea was to put Spare Bricks out, which Gilmore was already opposed to. Because he was like, if these songs were not good enough for the Wall, why should we put them out now?
Right, right.
But Roger had this idea. But as they're putting Spare Bricks together, Argentina invades the Falkland Islands. Now, I could ask you right now to give me everything you know about the Falkland Islands War. And me and you combined could probably go a total of 5 minutes.
I'm guessing. Wow, then you must know way more than me. I'm over here desperately Googling as fast as possible to see if the Falkland Islands are more near the UK or more near South America.
Much closer to South America.
Assuming you've looked it up before, what is your guess? Which of these empires is traveling thousands of miles to get into this baby skirmish?
So basically, the Falkland Islands had been under British control, but they were very... It's an island... You know, the British Empire.
This is basically like sort of the Key West situation, or it's not even... Hawaii is like a bad example of this. This is like the Caribbean to Argentina. It is right there. It is like just an island. Yeah. It's the Taiwan to China. That's what it is. That's
how close it is. I don't know where Key West comes into all this.
Sorry. Key West... Isn't Key West an island?
Key West is off the coast of Florida.
Yeah, but isn't it an island there, or is it not an island?
Yeah, but it's solidly Florida. Like, it's not, like, close to some other place. Like, it's definitely Florida.
Right, well, and that's what this is, but too. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not like not like a 1 mile distance, but this is, like, correct. This is definitely the like, Taiwan is, kind of distance. Yeah. Of, like, this is part of Argentina.
This almost. Is clearly South American territory, but it has been under British control. There's a great
map here where it shows kind of like the depth of the ocean with that kind of topographical view in Google Maps or whatever. And I can tell you there's this shelf that you can see that's like, here's where the continent of South America is, and here's where it like really just jumps into the sea. These islands are connected to Argentina in like what looks like, at least at a global level, like shallow fucking water between them. So obviously a British, like you said, outpost must have had some kind of gold or something. What's the story?
I don't know why Argentina decided to, quote, invade, other than supposedly they'd always believed that, like, that was their territory.
Sure. How dare they, Argentina's like in their backyard.
Argentina's like, we're taking it back. Taking back your territory.
Okay.
And Britain steps in and is like, no, you're not.
Right.
This is British territory. And now we have a war. Now, this is during the Margaret Thatcher years, which the more I read about Thatcher, the more I hear Trump type stuff. The more I hear, like, America first or
Britain first. So Thatcher was prime minister in the UK, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thatcher was prime minister of the UK and apparently was not afraid to get into a little skirmish here and there.
Okay, not just this Falkland Islands thing, but somewhere.
No, and I don't ask me for a breakdown of all of Thatcher's crimes through the years, but if you are on the liberal side of things, as I am, you will find that not many people on your side are big fans of Maggie Thatcher.
Okay.
So basically, as they're putting together spare bricks, Britain sends troops to the Falkland Islands. And Roger sees this as ridiculous. Like, we are sending troops for this tiny island. Surely there was a diplomatic way to work this out. Instead, we're in yet another war. Like, this, again, this promise of the post-war of World War II is a lie.
I mean, what the fuck even, like, is this? There's this whole shit about, like, I don't, man, again, the going back to Jane's quote of, you become a World War II guy or Vietnam guy or, like, a Roman Empire guy or whatever, like, my understanding is, like, India was a British territory, right? World War II happens, and one of the things that happens from it is, like, an agreement, I think, basically, again, like, we're gonna cut all of this because I'm so, like, woefully uneducated, but, like, basically, right, that is a major British territory that becomes its own country or some about along some agreed upon timeline, right, of this is basically my basic understanding is, like, this is not right, like, this shouldn't be this way, right? Like, as part of the aftermath and the fallout of World War II, I get this picture in my head that, again, is like a fucking American education halfway sleeping through it, usual, completely uninformed public school kind of view. And plus, you know, you and I were actually in religious school, so it's even more warped and fucked up than that. But I got this impression of the dudes, Stalin, Churchill, whoever, all these guys getting together in a room after World War II and agreeing, like, what does the world look like after this? Like, what is going to make this not happen again? And the India thing makes sense to me. And other things like becoming their own countries and not being British or French or whatever colonies anymore. What the fuck is going on here where it's like, why does Argentina have somebody in their back doorstep that Britain gives a shit about? This, like, little square, 12 square foot of, like, literally on the exact opposite side of the entire fucking world. Like,
exactly. Yeah, why does the British, quote, empire really matter?
Right.
Why do hockey teams in Canada still have pictures of the Queen in their arena into the 1990s?
Right.
I don't know the answers to those things, but I know that Roger Waters felt very strongly that this should not be the case.
Right.
And this war was really useless and really damaging and pointless. And so he abandons the spare brick ideas and he's like, boom, concept album. We're going to make an album about the Falklands Wars, which many of us have thought before.
Now, you have mentioned of before course. That... Gilmore said that in the 80s was kind of doing some rails, doing a little bit of cocaine. How with it is Gilmore at this
point? No, he's with out. It.
Mason sounds like he's been smartly, mostly just kind of pretty quiet and just bobbing along.
Yeah, no, I don't think Gilmore is doing a lot of cocaine at this point. In fact, so when here's the thing. When Roger has this idea, Gilmore does go along with it at first. Now, he doesn't like the... He didn't want to sing on the album very much because he didn't like the idea of just calling out Thatcher directly.
Okay.
He thought that was over the line.
Sure. And Gilmore, like, cheesy as fuck, man. Can you imagine? I mean, there are punk records today that say all this shit about Reagan. Like, what the fuck does a millennial now who's getting into the Sex Pistols or whoever give a shit about Reagan?
No, I get it. I think there's some courage to it. One of my favorite songs is Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, as I've mentioned before. And it calls out Nixon in the first line.
Sure.
I understand it's just it, but dated. It definitely dates it to the time.
Right.
For some reason, in America especially, we're so much more romantic for Vietnam protests than we are for 80s obscure war protests.
Well, like, I mean, The Hand That Feeds is like a protest song about George W. Bush, right? And, like, you know, this sort of like, hey, you shouldn't, we're being fed bullshit and we're not doing anything about it and stuff. But the lyrics are taking one level of abstraction further. But that song for the till the end of time is going to be a song that people can relate to, right?
Sure.
Rather than being like, oh, Maggie Thatcher in 1983. You know, had a couple of bad weeks, you know, and that's one of the things I think is a little bit hokey about the final cut is like, I feel like as a person who was born, like around the time this stuff happened, like when I get into this stuff in like the late 90s, I'm like, what the fuck is the Falkland Islands? You know? It's definitely a record about war and has these great sound effects and stuff that are going on where it's like, it's talking about, like, it seems a lot of, like, biographical, sort of, about the experience of leaders who are out of touch with the same time people who are on the ground being troops and stuff. And, like, what's the point of it? Right.
So, basically, what you had was Roger writing this album by himself.
Sure.
And Gilmore is in the book that I read and in Wikipedia, you'll see that it talks about how, like, Gilmore and Waters had a new, like, Atari.
Played Donkey Kong. Yeah.
And they would spend their time, like, playing Donkey Kong together and seemingly having a good time. But eventually what happened was, and I saw an interview today with Gilmore. This was probably on his About Face tour in 84, 85.
Okay.
Where they're interviewing him and they're asking about the final cut, which is interesting because I have not seen Gilmore ever say very much at all about the final cut.
Right.
And he basically says, like, it turned into Roger having this thing inside him that has this idea where he does not want to compromise. And he said, like, with the wall, we could compromise. Like, he had an idea. I would think I had an idea to make it better. And we would come up with a compromise. That's what you do.
Right.
And with the final cut, he was not interested in doing that anymore.
Right.
And so I would basically just come in and play the guitar when required. It was a Roger Waters solo album.
Yeah.
I mean, 100%. It was just a Roger Waters solo. This is Steve Jobs doing Next Computers, right? Yep. This is Roger being able to indulge the absolute worst of his instincts.
Right.
But at the same time, when I hear the final cut, I love it, but I can understand why it has absolutely no commercial appeal.
Right.
And you will find lots of Pink Floyd fans who say, I fucking love this album, but it does not have a Comfortably Numb. It does not have a Hey You. It does not have
I think Not a Now, John's Mother. The only one that approaches that. And that's,
which starts with Fuck All This, which means not going to get a lot of radio play.
Yeah, exactly. But it also is like it suffers that same problem as The Wall, where like I think that that song, I don't know if I've ever listened to it by itself because it really hits. Because of the song right before, which I forget the track listing exactly, but like it's like a suddenly like a bam, a boom of like this upbeat, like you know, like you said, fuck all that is like the you know the chorus to the thing of you know like we're gonna it's another version of what was it Us and Them. There was like this concept of like completely ignoring all the realities around you and doing it in the sake of like, you know, not having enough time or attention or whatever. And this one in particular was very similar lyric style to that. And yeah, in my personal opinion, that's the one that could be a single or something. Like you said, lyrical problems prevent that. But yeah, the rest of it, man, for me, it's the trial syndrome. There's the one that he tried to make into a single, or that at least was in the Final Cut movie heavily shown, was the Fletcher Memorial thing that's like mentioned after his dad. And I just feel that same like, here's what I learned from working with Ezrin on the trial. This is how I can fit a concept into this song, and I can make this little musical Broadway miniature piece or whatever. And I fucking hate that song. I hate it. And there's a couple of them that are like that where I'm just like, dude, this song is like, it's just so heavy handed and trying to fit like some goddamn music to a movie in his head. And it's
the opposite of like when I hear like, you know, after 9/11, a bunch of songs came out that were like country songs that were just like ridiculous.
Yes.
Like,
right.
And when you hear like Darryl Worley's, I remember this song, like, Have You Forgotten, where he's like, Have you forgotten about Bin Laden? And I'm like, okay, dude, just maybe throw me some metaphors first before you just say like, Have you forgotten about Bin Laden?
Exactly.
Like, it's too simple.
Right.
And I agree that this sometimes comes across that way.
Yeah, it hits some of those chords once in a while, or some of those nerves. Sorry, it hits some of those nerves once in a while, and like it's hard to recover from when there's not a lot of like stellar like moments otherwise, you know.
There's something to the idea of like, make me think about the song a little bit.
Yeah.
Versus just
it's that hands that feeds abstraction layer, right? He doesn't say George W. Bush in it, right? You know.
Right. But I think the first few songs, Post-War Dream, I love that song. I absolutely love it. Like
Well, and like, don't get me wrong. I was telling you today that like, you know, in preparation for this, I finally like the first time in like, man, forever, like probably since I was 19, listened to it a lot, like this last week, three or four times, like all the way through. And man, it is a solid production. Like the level of production of it and it is a great narrative. It definitely makes sense in the same way as The Wall. It's just, and I think it is, it's probably what you were just saying earlier, that basically Gilmore didn't have a lot of input and wasn't welcome. And so the rough edges were never like polished up. And so you get sort of the Comfortably Numb, ridiculous doctor suit bullshit, but none of the like polishing it up and making it something that's like transcendent. It's really interesting. You really do hear, like you're saying, where Gilmore is told to basically plug in the amp and record, because it'll just be out of nowhere, suddenly there's actually guitar, and it's Gilmore. You hear just this, like, really clipped in, like, this 1 millisecond, now there's guitar, it's an awesome solo, or something like this, and then it's like, bye guys, I'm out the door. Like, it just clips right back off, and now we're back into this sort of, you know, like I said, well-produced songs with, like, all of this stuff and all of this instrumentation's crazy and over the top and stuff. You do not hear Gilmore outside of those solos. And then, in my opinion, Not Now, John, which is kind of like a kicked up, comfortably numb vibe, sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the most aggressive song on the album.
Yeah, definitely.
And it speaks to you right away, but right. Also there's no way it's ever going to get on the radio.
Yeah.
When I hear like the Heroes Return,
yeah.
Like the Jesus, what's this all about?
Right.
Also
not going to get on the radio very easily in 1983.
No.
Yeah.
And the best to me the highlight of this album is The Gunner's Dream, which is basically this idea that there's this soldier who's been, like, shot out of his plane. He's falling to the earth. Okay. He's dying. He's going to die.
Right.
And he basically has this dream as he's dying of, like, what is this for? And he has this vision of what the world is like after he's gone.
That's pretty cool. Okay.
Like, what is this all worth?
Okay.
You know, it's the world should earn this. The world should earn my death.
Right.
And it's... it's a pipe dream, right? I think it to me, it highlights the futility of it all.
Right.
Like, this death was worth nothing. Nothing changed.
Right.
Nothing changed because of his death. And I think that's what the Falkland Islands War really highlighted to Roger, was like, nothing fucking changes.
Yeah.
Like, we fight this war, and then there's another war, and another one. And it's a game of whack-a-mole, and you can never end them.
Right, yeah.
And the diplomatic failures before the wars are what's really to blame. And The Gunner's Dream is a good highlight of that. Of like this fantasy of, okay, I've died, but it was worth something.
Right.
Things are, and he has these visions of like the people on one side and the other side seeing each other in the street and shaking hands.
Right.
Because everything's good now. And we know that's not true.
Right.
Right? We know that didn't happen.
Right, exactly.
But that was the idea behind the song. And actually, Roger, in the last few years, has played that song live for the first time ever.
Okay.
So
is that on the Us and Them track list? I can't remember. I
don't think it's on Spotify, but I know there are...
When I watched the Us and Them like video, like, I mean, it was such a great engrossing show that I was not keeping track of what songs they had even played.
No, it was funny because he played like almost all of Animals on that show.
Yeah, man, it's awesome.
Which was awesome. Yeah. I did not know that. But
yeah, he didn't
play
Dogs, which is important.
Well, but he played Pigs, three different ones, which is my favorite.
Right, and Sheep, I think
but
did it, maybe.
No, I don't think he played The Gunner's Dream in that show, but I know there were shows on that tour where he did play it.
Okay, cool.
Which he's never played anything from the final cut.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, this
so
album has been ignored.
When he did solo tours after this and such, he never was like, here's
no,
some of my...
No, this has been ignored. Like, completely ignored for years.
Yeah, for 40 years, basically, in 1984.
Yeah. And in the interview I saw with Gilmore from the mid-80s, he says, like, well, he's clearly backstage, like he's in the bowels of an arena,
yeah,
obviously, on his About Face tour, and he says, like, on the final cut, I think there are three good songs. He mentions that two or three times, that there are three good songs, and I've seen mentioned other places where, like, there are basically three songs with, like, blistering guitar solos,
right,
that Gilmore thinks are good,
right.
And the rest of it is, he's like, basically it was leftover stuff from the wall. And I argued with Roger, if it wasn't good enough for the wall, why is it good enough now?
Yeah.
And Roger was insistent, no. And so Gilmore just gave up. And that was the end of Pink Floyd. Like, it was, okay, this is what you want to do, just do it, and I'm done. And I cannot really come up with a good argument of why it did not work, because I think it's a damn good album. And if, especially listen to other stuff that came out in 1983.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the thing, but I think it's inaccessible. And it's not just that it's about the Falkland War a little bit or whatever. Like, it's not just that it calls out Margaret Thatcher or something. It's a concept record that is really harping on. Like, I have a hard time now when I'm older separating this one from the wall. So when I think of the wall and I think of the story of this kid who lost his father in the war, I think of the whole final cut sequence. I think of the thing of the overarching theme of war is pointless, or like, why do we keep finding ourselves back in this place, and this is reprehensible, and, you know, and Amused to Death comes to mind as well, too, which we'll talk about maybe a little bit when we get to, you know, this next segment, this next episode. It's the same thing as the Wall movie we were just talking about. It beats you over the head nonstop about war and about the realities of war and all these kinds of things, which, I mean, I don't know. Do soldiers who come home who have PTSD want to listen to music about that? Probably not. Do everyday people who have soldiers in their family want to listen to things about that? Probably not. It's like just an inaccessible thing. The Wall, you could take the first disc of it, and there's like, what, I don't know, a mention of sort of like, you know, daddy dying in a war, like in the first couple of tracks. And the rest of that thing is like a whole segment about, you know, mama, and then like the whole thing of like a relationship breaking down and stuff. The whole second side of the record is like a person going into like a psychotic break and stuff. It's, yeah, it's for better or for worse, even if it's not necessarily, I guess, totally relatable on a protagonist level for people, it's just, it's a lot of different stuff. It's relatable human themes. Not to say the war is not a relatable human theme, and regret and all the things, and the guilt and all the stuff, but this is the same thing as Animals, and I don't know how well the Animals did or whatnot, but this is like dark, heavy shit that is just, man, yeah. It takes a very certain mood, it takes a very certain personality, and in particular this one is extremely political.
Yeah,
you know, it's the same as those. I always get the guy's name, Toby Keith. It's the same as like how off-putting the 9/11 profiteering Toby Keith kind of bullshit was.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
we'll put a boot in your ass.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just as like, I don't know, gross as that somehow. You know, and it's heavy.
Yeah. It's heavy. There's a distinction to be made, because I would say that, like, I love it.
Yeah.
And I think it's great.
Production values are through the fucking roof. Like, that was the thing that killed me, as I was listening to it. And I'm like, dude, I struggle to find records today. And when I do, I hold on to them for dear life, because I just do not make records with this level of precision. But you got to be a fucking madman to do it. It's insane.
This could have been made today, and it would have sounded in place.
Dude, every vocal line he delivers has this effect or that effect to make it sound mm-hmm. like somebody's whispering in the background for one word. I mean,
But that's why I can hear it, and I can say, I fucking love this album.
Yeah.
But I can also understand why it has no commercial appeal at all.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think you think it's great. Yeah. I think it's brilliant. I think it's an absolute genius album.
Sure.
Rolling Stone called it the crowning like masterpiece of art rock.
Kurt Loder in particular.
Right? And Kurt Loder is not like just a random like reviewer, right? Like, he is the quintessential Rolling Stone like rock review guy.
Was he?
Yeah.
I didn't know until we started doing this that he even was like a journalist before he was, you know, when we grew up, he was the MTV news guy, you know.
I know he was. Yeah. But no, he was the big time Rolling Stone guy. So
yeah.
So basically they're giving him the big stuff.
Sure.
Now I will admit that Rolling Stone has a vested interest in giving really great reviews to big bands.
Sure.
And we've seen this over and over again.
How many Final Cut advertisements, full page ads were in Rolling Stone leading up to that month? And
I don't know, but I know that if they give the Final Cut one star, how many interviews do they get with Roger or David?
For the rest of eternity.
Ever, right?
Yeah.
And the answer is zero. So I understand that goes both ways,
I guess, huh?
But I also hear the Final Cut, I read the review, and I'm like, I agree with it. I think it's genius. I think it's great.
Yeah.
But I can understand why it does not have the commercial appeal of the Wall.
Right, completely. Exactly. Yeah, Nine Inch Nails did this too. They had a political record. And Man, it's hard. It has the same undertones as the final cut, and it's
right.
You know, it's like this dystopian / sci-fi like surveillance state thing that like in 2006 when it came out or 7 or whatever. You're like, man, this is so dark. Maybe the world's gonna get to be this, and now in 2021, you're like just hanging your head, like, man,
right?
This is a soundtrack for like what 2014 was like. God damn it! I remember 2007 being like, whoa. Cool Blade Runner future, like, you know, dystopian sad guy idea, and you're like, man, fuck this.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem, for at least for now, like legacy wise I mean, listening to this is like, man, it's, and I am a dude who loves depressing music and whatever, but I'm like, god damn it. I guess I go back to that quote that you've told me, he says, where he's like, you know, people are like, well, are you proud that your stuff holds up? And he's like, no, I fucking hate it. It's completely idiotic that I made these statements 40 fucking years ago and nothing has changed.
Yeah.
Like, it's depressing as fuck. And I think
he said, I wish it was not still relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my hope, that would not still be relevant at this point.
Right.
But it is.
Right. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I think Roger, when I see him today post like YouTube videos, I see a guy who's really fucking frustrated.
Yeah, definitely.
That he's still having to talk about this shit.
Right.
That's all I see.
Right.
Now, you could say, like, he is 77 years old.
Right.
And maybe he should just take a step back.
Right.
He does not have that in him.
Right, right.
Like, he doesn't have mechanism.
I mean, this is going to be incredibly dated by the time this ships or whatever, but there's some stuff going on in Israel and Palestine, and, like, if we just kind of gloss over what it is, people will be like, well, wait, 2021, which was it, this one or that one or that one?
Oh, sure.
Or whatever, which is how it's been with them forever or whatnot, but you show me this video, and it's like, man, if nothing else, this guy is, like, completely serious. Like, he has, like, a little, you know, basically a TikTok video on YouTube of him being like, man, fuck this. What is Biden doing about this? You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he's a tried and true believer. And it's hard to relate to, because I think of myself at that age, and I'm like, man, I hope I am just living on a fucking mountain somewhere, not giving a flying fuck about anything.
Yeah.
That's what I hope for my life at that point.
He's a man with conviction, man.
He cannot turn this off.
Yeah. And hats off to him, dude. Like,
oh, no, completely. I completely agree. Like, if I said this earlier to you offline about Bono, about how, like, okay, Bono does what he does, but sometimes it feels like performance art.
Yeah.
I feel like Roger has the same beliefs, but really does not give a shit if anyone likes them or not.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
Like, he posts this video about this Palestinian-Israel conflict that, in my mind, does not win anybody over in any way.
Sure.
Right? Like, he's just like an old dude
ranting into the thing.
He's just an old dude who has not had a haircut in a long time, who is just pissed off.
And
he's going live. He's just going to record himself and throw it on YouTube.
He put out, like, he's been doing this awesome during COVID, like, once in a while, like, black and white shot, socially distanced videos of him doing, like, mostly acoustic versions of his songs. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Mother was the first one, right? And it was fucking chilling. It was so good. And the one he put out a fucking week ago was The Bravery of Being Out of Range.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Which is this awesome song off his solo record, Amused to Death. It's all about, like, people who are completely out of touch, who are safe in their homes, making the call to kill people and the call for their own people to go risk their lives to go kill people, and they're just so brave, and they're the heroes of the world. And it's like talking about presidents and you know, generals and all these people who are supposedly leading these wars and making these decisions, and they're like, at no point are they endangered at all, period. It's like such fucking hypocrisy. He puts that thing out a week ago, and I mean, hats off to him to, like, not be like fucking pimping, you know, a Dolce Gabbana, you know, purse on his Instagram a week later. He's like, dude, this is exactly what I'm fucking talking about. I just sang a song that's 30 fucking years old. about this exact problem. What the fuck is going on? I mean, dude is consistent. That's
He's a tried and true believer. There's no question whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
He is a hardcore believer in what he believes in. And that will never change.
Right.
And
I mean, he sounds like he's insufferable to work with. And that's...
Oh, for sure.
And you know what? And that's probably well-earned, and that's probably completely true.
Well...
But dude, he can take it. For all his
We'll get into more of that in the next episodes about how, like, after he leaves Pink Floyd, like, the trouble he's had in finding people to work with him.
Right.
Because that's a thing, for sure. Right,
sure. Yeah.
But there's no doubt, like... You cannot argue that he is doing this for performance art. He's doing this for him. No. Yeah. He is a 100% true believer, which is a gap between him and Gilmore.
Sure.
Gilmore is also a liberal guy.
Yeah. I got a quote here about the Final Cut era for him.
Okay.
There were all sorts of arguments over political issues, and I didn't share his political views, explained Gilmore in 2000, but I never wanted to stand in the way of him expressing the story of the Final Cut. I just didn't think some of the music was up to it. Gilmore's, it says bugbear, which must be a word this author made up, was that four of the pieces making up the new song cycle, quote-unquote, I guess that means the like totally new pieces that were added, Your Possible Past, One of the Few, The Final Cut, and The Hero's Return were scraps from The Wall, which had been earmarked for the Spare Bricks album. Although the band had frequently recycled from their quote-unquote rubbish library in the past, you know, Us and Them was like from the rubbish library, for example, right? I mean, parts of it. Gilmore was adamant that these particular items just weren't good enough. So, yeah, and, you know, and Roger, for his part, of course, is, you know, like, well, at least I'm writing songs. Dave wanted me to wait. And here's the quote. Dave wanted me to wait until he had written some more material. But given that he'd written maybe three songs in the previous 5 years, I couldn't see what that was going when that was going to happen.
which Gilmore had admitted was a problem.
Like, yeah, we got back and forth here. Gilmore has since admitted, I'm certainly guilty at times of being lazy. And moments have arrived where Roger might say, well, what have you got? And I'd be like, well, I haven't got anything right now. I need a bit more time to put some ideas on tape. There are elements of all this, this stuff that years later you can look back on and say, well, he had a point there. But he wasn't right about wanting to put some duff tracks on the Final Cut. I said to Roger, if these songs weren't good enough for The Wall, like you said, why are they good enough now? Let's see. As Bob Ezrin recalled from The Wall sessions, David was a little more taciturn back then. He did a lot of smiling and rarely went toe-to-toe. But when he did, he was completely unmovable. Unfortunately, and I think we missed this part, Ezrin, the great mediator, was not available to help. He had been banished to Pink Floyd's personal Siberia after accidentally revealing secret information about the Wall stage show and had been busy producing albums for other partners such as Alice Cooper and Kiss. So that's part of it, too. No, like the two I've mediators that helped Roger bring the Wall to what it was, you know, the trial aside or whatever, they're gone. This dude's like floating on his own. And, you know, like, I don't know. I see this over and over again. The Pumpkins suffered the same kind of problem. I think Nine Inch Nails, in my opinion, up until like just very, very recently, there was an EP that was like basically David Bowie stuff. It was kind of strange. I feel like it's one of those, like, this one's for me kind of records or something.
No, history is littered with bands who think they can do it on their own.
Right.
Or artists who think they can do it on their own.
Right.
When in reality, they had a partner or a producer.
Yeah.
Who played a huge part.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, this is not an uncommon story.
Right.
So, listen, I love the Final Cut.
It is Roger's first solo record. And to be fair,
basically,
around this time, it looks like 78 is David Gilmour's first solo record. 84, also, a year after this, is another solo record.
I believe the Final Cut was credited to Roger Waters, performed by the Pink Floyd. So it was clearly a Roger. Basically, Roger had taken control of the band at this point.
Right.
And Gilmore had been like, at the end of it, he was like, okay, this is your thing. You want to do it? I'll just let you do it.
Right.
I'll come in and do the guitar solos, and that's it.
Right.
That's the end of this album.
Right.
And he did it, and the album came out. It met was a like a thud, right? Like they did not make a huge splash.
Right.
And that's the end of
Pink Floyd. Sounding contractual a little. That might give a little bit of a explanation here. I got a quote.
Okay. Please.
Waters has since hinted that he threatened to put it out as a solo record, but as the band were contracted to EMI to make a Pink Floyd album, it seems unlikely that the company would have permitted this.
Right.
Yeah, even Waters later admit, not everything can be a fucking masterpiece. That sounds like a Waters quote. But even despite that, Pink Floyd could never be accused of complacency. I think that's a good way of putting it, this author in the
book
that we'll link in our podcast episode. So I think maybe that's part of it, too. Maybe that's part of why, I don't know, if Gilmore's making solo records and stuff, and he makes a solo record before or around the time of The Wall, he's making this one later, like, Gilmore's doing his own thing, it sounds like, you know? Like, he's mentally checked out of this brand.
No, I think he's seen that, like, his word doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah. And he's not, and I mean, like that quote we just saw where Ezra said that when he did dig in his heels, there's no moving him and whatever, but that's a lot of energy to fucking expend compared to, you know, presumably how it was not that bad in the Dark Side days, right? To get the band working together.
No, things have changed at this point.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And the album comes out, and there is no tour.
Right.
There is no promotion. There is no anything.
Like,
it's it. Like, this is the end of Pink Floyd as we know it. There is another iteration later on, but this is the end of the classic Pink Floyd era. The final cut comes out, and that's it. It's like REM came out with their last album. They didn't tour, and they just announced, like, we're breaking up.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was it. That was the end of REM, right?
Yeah.
This is Pink Floyd. They did not announce they were breaking up. In fact, in this interview I saw with Gilmore, he even said, like, well, if... And he's using the word if. Like, if we make another album, it will be under different circumstances. It will be with, like, different rules.
Hmm.
Even he is not, like, closing the door
in
the mid-80s on another album.
Right. Yeah, I mean, every time they do it, they make millions of dollars. I mean, I think maybe we lost this. In the discussion of The Wall really quickly, but like the tax exile thing, I think we mentioned maybe offhandedly, but they like lost like all of their money and or had huge tax burdens that they needed to pay back. So they went to exile living outside of the country while recording The Wall and other solo records and whatever. And their tax people or money people generally told them they need to make as much money as possible during that year. So you make this money. Now you have this money. It's not taxed at 83% or whatever the crazy tax rate was. And you're, I don't know if they're rich again necessarily, or they're just have enough money to at least pay the back taxes on things. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly, but it sounded like they're basically, aside from maybe assets they physically owned, like basically bankrupt or something, which is insane. And, you know, you talked about last episode or two episodes ago about how, like, you know, it was like kind of like the Elvis situation where people bled them dry and maybe they didn't know it to some degree and they made bad investment decisions and all this kind of stuff. You know, bouncing back from that with The Wall selling like ultimately 20 million records again, like Dark Side had, you know, and then, of course, I'm sure that also lifted up all the old back catalog making money. Who gives a shit? You don't even have to tour. I can see Gilmore, despite all of this, being like, man, every time Roger does this, despite all of his, like, angry late nights, driving himself mad and stuff, Like, I get, you know, another $1 million in my pocketbook. Like, I'm not closing the door on that. You know, I like making records, you know, but it, yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things. And I guess we'll talk about that next time. I mean, Roger leaves, right?
Well, I think the other guys left, but then realized we hold all the cards.
Interesting.
So that's a discussion for next. That's the the heartbeat, the boom, boom. Boom, boom.
For next time, guys.
For next time.
That's awesome.
Cool. Because there is another chapter and there is a twist. And if Keith Morrison were telling this story, it would be quite riveting.
Great.
But it's not Keith Morrison. It's me and you.
Well.
But it's still going to be interesting. It is a plot twist. It is like a wild ass plot twist that this one guy has taken control of the band. And then in the next chapter, he has no control over the band.
Styx part two, man.
How the fuck does that happen?
Styx part two.
Well,
did the Styx thing happen before this or after this?
Around the same time.
Yeah, that's interesting. For our listeners who haven't heard that episode from a million years ago, the Styx, one of the main personalities in the band, arguably the one, got sick or something and didn't want to tour with them for a little bit. And they're like, great, you're out of the band. And it's like,
yeah,
what?
You're out. Yeah.
And they never invited him back.
That did happen kind of after the Pink Floyd drama happened.
Sure. Well, and like, I mean, that's what Waters did to Wright, you know. So it sounds like karma's a bitch, and we'll figure that out next episode.
Next episode, man.
Cool. All right, guys.
Big stuff.
Thanks for listening.
Cool.
See ya.